Okay, let's get started. Our next discussion will focus on the transparency and governance of audit firms, with more than half of you, 10 out of 17, suggesting that improved transparency and governance of audit firms was one of your top four priorities for the PCAOB to consider. This subject matter is clearly an important one. Many of the topics you brought up reiterated the Treasury Advisory Committee's recommendations. Five of you suggested that firms should be required to have some form of annual financial statements, which was also a recommendation from the Treasury Advisory Committee. Five of you feel that the firm should have independent board members or advisory committees, another recommendation from the Treasury Advisory Committee. Five of you indicated that firms should disclose audit quality indicators, and six of you would have us require the engagement partner signature on audit reports, also a recommendation of the Treasury Advisory Committee. Beyond that, some of you feel that we need to better understand firm structure and competition, strengthen independence rules, as well as review auditor accountability to share owners. Ann Simpson, you stated, the review of auditor accountability to share owners in the U.S. is patchy, and a review of international practice may be useful. Pete, you feel that providing more visibility inside public accounting firms is vital to the investment community given the importance of the audit process to the functioning of our financial system. And Lynn, you are concerned that we require both, quote, the auditor to sign the report, the partner's name, and have the auditors file an annual report with the PCAOB, which includes a report on a list of quality indicators, a set of audited financial statements, much as they do in the UK and elsewhere, a report on their governance, which I believe should include, as the Treasury report recommends, outside directors, close quote. So without further delay, let me turn the discussion over to you, Ann Simpson, Pete Nakdwe, and Lynn.
Thank you very much. We're going to keep this short and sweet and get us back on track with the timing, I hope. So I want to start by quoting Gandhi, which is a noble thing to do in all circumstances. And he was asked, what did he think about Western civilization? And he said, it would be a good idea. So our topic today is transparency and governance of audit firms. And our panel would like to recommend, it would be a good idea. So let's to the details. I think that the items which our chairman has quoted from the ACAP report deserve to be commended and they deserve to be implemented. I just want to focus on a couple of points which I think are really important, and I don't think ACAP really dug into the details. Now, we're assuming that the PCAOB has the big stick. Now, you will talk softly, but you do have a big stick here. But we would like to see, well, certainly CalPERS would like to see, the big stick of regulation reinforced by some market pressures. And the first is to ensure that we have a regime in which the audit firm is ratified by the share owners. If we don't have a model of accountability that's working, we're going to be in great difficulty. And we know, regardless of the resources and the competence and the energy the regulator brings to it, we really do need shareholders to be scrutinising what's put before them on the audit. Now, why don't share owners particularly care at the moment about the ratification of the auditors? I think because it's just viewed as some form-filling. The structure of the audit market is so concentrated, there is so little choice and so little to understand about the quality of one firm versus the other. I suggest that really what Sharon has been focusing on is the board and the audit committee, which is good. But I think that if more information were to be provided, you would find that the shareholders would buttress what the regulators need to be paying attention to. So financial statements, audited, yes, absolutely. I would also suggest that this needs to be expanded to include governance information, which we require as a matter of routine from companies. So the leadership of the firm, the structure of the corporate affiliations, this is absolutely critical and very relevant to what we were talking about beforehand. I would suggest the idea of independence in the governance structure although I would, I don't know how to put this in a polite way, being British it sounds so disloyal. I mean, the Financial Reporting Council is now requiring from June the 1st the UK part of these tangled webs of spaghetti called audit firms, the UK part will have to produce audited financial statements and will have to report on the extent to which they have independent people involved in the governance of the partnership. Now this seems to me very, very awkward, because these firms are partnerships, and independence only works if you're accountable. And as there are not external capital providers to whom the independent board or executives or non-executives, sorry, can be made accountable, I simply don't see how that will work. And the UK has a wonderful history of window dressing and looking as though we're doing the right thing, and I fear this will head in the same direction. The final point I want to flag up is about some of the other detail in the UK code, which I do think is probably worth looking at, and I'm not going to quote in detail, it's all available on the FRC website. But they've introduced some interesting ideas that audit quality indicators need to be reported upon, which is something the ACAP committee of inquiry recommended. But they also would like some parallel provisions to be reported on around risk management and mechanisms like whistleblowing. And I think that if we are continuing to rest the mighty weight of audit upon a handful of opaque, privately owned partnerships, which are not disclosing their many and myriad corporate relationships around the world, we really have got a weak link in the governance chain, not just in the US and the UK, which have reasonably well regulated markets, but in many other markets around the world. So I'll turn over to my esteemed co-panelists, Pete and Lynn.
Thank you, Anne. I wish I had a great Gandhi quote, but we'll have to pass on that for now. But maybe before luncheon, just a couple of thoughts and ideas just to give you a sense of perspective that I bring at this is, in the interest of full disclosure, I spent 27 years at Deloitte, almost 20 of those as a partner. So that's kind of perspective one. But I then have three other perspectives coming from my role at Carlyle since 2007. Two of those are as a client, because we hire the accounting firms to help us do due diligence on companies that we're acquiring. And these are companies that are already audited, generally by a Big Four firm, yet we feel the need to go hire another Big Four firm to come in and check what they've done, which is an interesting fact of life. And says something about how audits, again, are conducted and who they're conducted for. And in the second place that we're kind of a client is they audit our firm, they audit our funds, they audit our portfolio companies after we've acquired them. So kind of those three perspectives. And then the last one is probably the reason I'm sitting here, which is as an investor. And so we're relying on, or maybe not relying on, but at least looking at the audits and the financial statements that they've audited of target companies. So with that in mind, I'm going to speak mostly from my last perspective, but want to make sure everybody understands it's informed by a couple of others. And I do think this group and the PCOB in particular can be helpful in promoting some transparency of the audit firms. And I think we have to do it, or PCOB has to do it, being mindful of the fact that they are private. As Anne pointed out, there's some unique challenges to that. They're not only private, they're private partnerships. But having said that, they do have a duty to the public and the society, not just in our country, but elsewhere, have entrusted them with a very important duty to the public, and therefore I think we have a right to demand some transparency, maybe more than we've had in the past. I'll add a few things to what Ann said, and I know Lynn's got some other great ideas, but the three things that I would focus on from a transparency standpoint, in addition to what my fellow panelists are going to say, client acceptance would be one. Second is the global networks, and we talked about those before, but we'll share maybe a couple of ideas there. And then third is on kind of insurance and how they focus on protecting themselves in that regard. But on the client acceptance front, I do think the old adage that all of our parents or some mentor generally taught us at an early age is you're known by the company you keep. And certainly Anderson, we can pick on them since they're no longer here, would wish they never kept company with Enron or Sunbeam or Waste Management or WorldCom. And so very often these firms are getting in trouble, not so much because of whether they did a good job auditing or not, but who did they let in the door in terms of the people that they were going to audit. So that would be one issue of understanding how they think about client acceptance. Second piece of that is, who do you decide to retain? Because just because a company was great when you brought them on board doesn't necessarily mean they continue to be great. How do you think about management changes? How do you think about risk and so forth in terms of retaining clients? And then, corollary to that is, kind of the other end of the pipeline of, they are private businesses that we need to be successful. There's only four of them left. As an investor, we get into a wicked amount of complexity in trying to make sure they're all independent of us, or who can we hire that doesn't have a conflict? And to go down to three firms, I think, would be a bit of a tragedy for our U.S. economy and global economy. How do we help prevent that? One of the ways is they have to have a viable stream of revenues that's going to come from new clients. So this is kind of circular, but it's a very important aspect, I think, of understanding their business model. And in most businesses, a key performance indicator would be, who are the new clients that you've let in that year and why, and then who are the ones that maybe you fired. Again, gets into a delicate issue of disclosure. Second, global networks. And we talked a good bit about this, so I'll try not to repeat some of the things we said earlier, but the quality of the affiliates and how they think about that. And I am intrigued with the idea that we have the ability, the PCOB has the ability maybe to get at some of the things that foreign regulators don't let us get at by having the big four firms do that, because they already do it. I mean, they spend a lot of time diligencing anybody that's new to the network, I think it's a little less transparent what they do in terms of who they retain in the network. So it's similar to the client acceptance and client retention. You have a similar issue with the global affiliates. And then the last item, insurance, which we don't very often talk about. I think most of the big four at this stage, it used to be insured back when they were the big eight. There was insurance available. I think there's less so today, but there still is insurance. The fact that they have formed a little bit of a keiretsu to try and pass the hat and share liability around amongst the four of them, but I don't think it's well understood. It's a delicate balance, again, in our litigious society, though, of getting it really well understood may just draw a roadmap for the plaintiff's bar. I'll close with a vignette, since I couldn't open with a Gandhi, which is so there's a little bit of tension between accountants and lawyers. So the definition that I grew up with about accountants is and auditors is, we come in after the battle's lost and bayonet the wounded. But the one step down, I suppose, in the food chain was the lawyers, and I apologize to all the lawyers in the room, but they come in after the accountants and strip the bodies. So the challenge is, if we just simply put a big target up there by having everybody understand their insurance program that should be there to help benefit shareholders or stakeholders that are harmed in a business failure, if all it does is it ends up being one pull on the lottery or on the roulette wheel handle for one set of lawyers in one case, that probably won't do much for the public good. But I think those three areas would be client acceptance, global networks, insurance programs would be interesting.
Yeah. If I recall right, Charlie and Dan, aren't you both an auditor and an attorney?
I tried to insult everybody at once.
Lynn Turner. When the Treasury Committee looked at the accounting profession, some of the issues that Pete raised as well as Ann raised were discussed and, quite frankly, vetted in depth. There were concerns about the governance of the profession, whether they were too internally focused and really getting a useful outside perspective like we see the management teams of public companies able to obtain from their boards. There were issues about financial sustainability and viability that Pete raised with the insurance issues. And there was discussion around the concentration, the fact that we only have four of these firms. And I think at the end of the day, the reality set in that we only got four, and even though some of the other firms down below, Grant Thornton, BDO Seidman, McGladrey, Croce's, may do a very fine job, the reality is you could combine all those up and they don't even get to the size of the fourth one. So the reality is we're stuck with these four unless someone decides to go ahead and go in and break them up, and doesn't seem to be any political stomach here in Washington, D.C. So the reality is we've got four. Given that, there's no question it is a major, major systemic risk in the system and something that has to be overseen, has to be wisely dealt with, and needs to be regulated. And from that perspective, it's somewhat surprising, if not even amazing, especially in light of what we've gone through in the focus on risk and what's in the currently pending legislation, that to this day the PCAOB is not getting the fundamental information it needs to manage such a huge systemic risk. And it's a systemic risk to investors, a systemic risk to the public companies and the participants. And there's no question that Sarbanes-Oxley does give you the authority to go get that information. And fundamentally, you have to start with, obviously, your inspections give you a basis for some very useful information. But more importantly, though, it's important that one understands the financial stability of these firms as well. They tend to be lowly capitalized because they're distributing most of the income each year, so partners can pay the taxes, so there's very little capital in them. They use a revolving line of credit financed by the receivables that's paid off each year, so that tees up some leverage issues as well. And they have large, huge pensions to a large degree unfunded. A decade ago on one of them, that number was $9 to $10 billion. It's had to grow exponentially, so it's relatively huge in relation to the revenues of the firms as well. As partners have described it to me, it's their version of the Ponzi scheme, because they're using the current earnings to pay the retirements of the old partners, and the young partners who are paying for it just hope they're able to get old and retire and get paid before it that becomes bigger. So in light of that, it is important that the PCAOB start getting the information that one has to have to manage such a significant systemic risk, which would include items that have already been discussed. I think it starts with some of the information we find the motherland, quite frankly, requires in the annual report from their large firms. They require an annual report. They require it be audited and it be made publicly available. You would tag on to that the things that Ann recommended then, a discussion about the governance, a discussion about the structure of the firm, discussing the affiliate notion, because they are clearly just affiliates. And as we've seen in court case after court case now, every time there's a case brought and the shareholders try to reach out to one of the affiliates, the firms make it very clear and make a very clear argument in each court case that they have nothing to do with one another. They don't oversee one another. They don't set their audit quality standards whatsoever. You can look at any of these court documents in any of the court cases, and you'll see the same arguments being made time and time again. So it's important that you learn and understand the structure in that annual report. There should be the annual audited financial statements, just as they do in the UK. The point about client acceptance is so important, and how they go through that client acceptance, because we found, as we did with Anderson and as Pete appropriately noted time and time again, people, while they tell us they've got great client acceptance standards, it seems always if the fee's big enough, people go for it. We've recently seen the case where one firm been doing the audit for $4 million, or another one has now come in and picked that audit up for $1 million, which raises a serious question here. And we should also have disclosure in there about key metrics in terms of quality control factors. It's another thing that the ACAP took up, principally because of a recommendation from a former retired Big Four partner that I think put forward some excellent recommendations and had focused on the right type of quality control factors. That goes beyond what's in the EU 8th directive, which I think is a good starting point, but it's only that. The EU directive is only a starting point, and there needs to be, you cannot manage such a grave systemic risk if all you're getting is what's in the EU 8th directive. I also think that it's important that from an investor perspective, we talk a little bit about a regulator perspective, investors now are given the chance to vote on these auditors the majority of the times on an annual basis. And we need to make sure that we give the investors the information to make an informed decision if we're going to ask them, and in fact they want to be able to vote on them. So we need to make sure that not only we're getting this annual report out there, but we also want to know who is the audit partner that we're voting on. And in many foreign countries, France, UK, elsewhere, they tell us not only who the firm is, and that's important because the firm's behind the audit report and sets the overall quality control standards, but it's equally important, I've always believed, that your audit is only as good as your audit partner. And we're entitled as investors to know who is that audit partner that's doing the audit for us. And some people have complained, well, if I do that, it'll increase my liability. That's absolutely false and a misnomer. By signing your name, you don't change your liability one iota. And the firms have said here in the U.S., oh, we don't want to do the public report like they do in the U.K. because people will be able to see our finances and people sue us more often or something. But that's absolutely a misnomer. In any of these court cases, the court always ultimately admits the financial statements of the firm anyway, so they get them regardless. So that's a kind of a Chicken Little running around the sky is falling type argument that just doesn't hold water whatsoever. So there's, in light of the systemic risk and in light of the investors wanting to vote on this important decision to them, it is key that we get much more transparent, that the PCAOB gets that transparent information. I fear for the PCAOB, again, if you had a problem with one of these major firms and you hadn't even been getting the financial statements on that firm, what would your defense be to the public about how you regulated risk? You couldn't even or didn't even get a financial statement that showed on a real GAAP basis what this thing really looked like with all those pension obligations and liabilities. And I don't think there's going to be any answer that would save you on the front page of a New York Times. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, there are a large number of categories of issues there. I think we could start with any number of different questions. I don't know who wants to open it up. I've got some, but Tony, we're here to get your input. Yeah. So,
I was just wondering what type of information about the audit firm's risk assessments do you get today? And what is it that you could ask for? Because I've asked audit firms on how they make those decisions, and as Lynn pointed out, when you replace an audit firm that was conducting your audit for $4 million with somebody who was conducting it for $1 million, as an investor, I'd like to know which one of those was wrong. I don't think it's obvious directionally by just looking at that number. But I have also asked audit firms about what they do, and I think things may have changed today, but for a long time, I don't think they were conducting anything that one could call as worthwhile risk analysis to determine which audits, which clients they should take. And I think the systemic risk of fundamentally the principle that the three of you have told us is that it's too few to fail. And it seems just as bad as the too big to fail. And I think both of them ought to be permitted to do so, because otherwise the risks for the rest of us is rather significant. So the other thing I was wondering about, there was a recent audit firm that had issues with Bally Fitness, for example, and they've been asked to hire an outside consultant to tell them whether they're doing a reasonable job of their internal controls and those kinds of things, and how they take information up to the technical, to the national office and so on. And I was intrigued. I said, I wonder who's going to be competent enough to do that sort of analysis. And, you know, but not a word has been heard of that since. I suspect there's something going on there. But that's the kind of thing that I think it would be worth getting additional information on and being able to do something in order to protect the investors and, in effect, to be able to do your job in your case.
You said that providing more visibility to key aspects of interest to the public inside public accounting firms is vital to the investment community, given the importance of the audit process to the functioning of our financial system. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the types of financial information about a public accounting firm that you think is needed.
Well, I think, you know, Lynn hit on one aspect is the, you know, the pension liability. There is some overhang for that, and how do firms manage that? It generally is unfunded. I think in all cases it's unfunded, in part because there are tax rules that don't allow them to get a deduction, and ERISA doesn't allow you to have an ERISA protective plan for a partnership. So therefore they tend to, you know, have these unfunded liabilities. But how do you deal with the fact that, you know, there is that overhang, and are creating such an amount of overhang for the younger partners in terms of being able to operate the firm viably? I generally think from my prior experiences that, or at least my own experience with one firm, is that it's well managed, but, you know, I don't know that for sure for the other three firms. Another aspect is just simple, you know, basic blocking and tackling. Are they able to, you know, kind of manage the balance sheet and, you know, make sure that, number one, they have adequate liquidity to operate the business, that they're not having trouble with clients in terms of being able to pay their bills and operate the business, and are they keeping an appropriate amount of reserve? As Lynn said, you know, for tax reasons, you generally tend to, tax and other reasons, you generally pay out all the earnings of the firm on an annual basis, but what are you saving? These are multi-billion dollar enterprises. You know, how conservative or aggressive are they being in terms of managing the balance sheet and keeping some sort of liquidity reserve? So those would be the things I would focus on. I don't know if my panelists are going to get there.
I mean, what's about... Sorry, I'm actually sharing Pete's question, so I should be on his microphone. I just wondered if you'd say a bit more about this insurance issue, because it seems to me at the root of much evil, or certainly much of the problem that we're tackling here, because the introduction of limited liability for the joint stock company was, in a sense, you know, what set capitalism running free. And the fact that we have this partnership structure and reliance on insurance seems to me you've got a whole model where you've embedded, you know, risk aversion into the system at a time when you actually need auditors to be bold, to be creative, to be investigative. How much can insurance solve that problem? Or, you know, how are we going to deal with, the perverse consequences of unlimited liability? I mean, it sounds like a good way of holding their feet to the fire, but then they just, you know, don't want to be anywhere near it.
The liability is probably made bigger in the press media than what it really is. I mean, it's a concern to firms, and you're always worried about the one lawsuit that might bring you down. But on the other hand, the partnership structure does keep skin in the game, which keeps people's attention. The one situation where we've had a gatekeeper in a corporate structure is credit rating agencies. They didn't have skin in the game, so to speak, and we saw that the corporate structure drove nothing but a bottom-line mentality, and for a gatekeeper, it certainly didn't work. So the partnership structure, I don't think, is the problem. It does keep people focused on, I think, to a large degree, the right things. On the liability issue, shareholders have never brought down one of the big firms. Shareholders have always negotiated to a settlement. The largest settlement was against Ernst & Young with Cendant. And even there, Lazar Fair was brought in. They examined what the viability of the firm was and its ability to pay and came up with a number. And the shareholder, which was actually TIA Cref at the time, agreed to a reasonable number. The only place we've got into a situation where you've had the possibility of a firm failing is where the government itself was instituting a penalty, such as we saw on Anderson, or in the early 1990s out of the S&L crisis, the Fed came close to imposing a fine on two firms, KPMG and EY, that would have failed both of them. And at the time, the head of the GAO stepped in and was able to talk the Fed into taking a lower number that would allow both firms to survive. So it hasn't been an issue with shareholders. And in fact, today, the largest lawsuits often are not from shareholders. They're from other companies or the corporations themselves suing the investors. So, but everyone seems to understand that at the end of the day, you don't want to put one of these firms down. I don't see a shareholder ever putting one of the big four firms down at this point. So as long as the government is acting in a responsible fashion and there's reasonable governance and oversight over the firms, so they're not doing things like what KPMG was doing with the tax shelters. I can't imagine an outside board stepping in a situation like KPMG where they were selling the tax shelters and actually had discussions about the fact that they could make so much more money than any of the fines would ever be that they ought to go ahead and do it. You just aren't going to see that. So if you can get good governance in them, I think that solves a lot of the insurance issue or concern. And then it's just up to the PCAOB. They could always get information on the insurance and request that. And that, along with the financial statements, would give them some flavors to where you're getting into an untenable situation.
Norman, I know that you raised in terms of your priorities some market structure and concentration issues. I don't know whether you want to talk about that here whatever.
No, I think it's probably a good time. I'll be brief because I know there are many others at the table who have views on the subject as well. But I think there is a broader issue here about market structure that I hope at some point in the work of this group we'll have a chance to discuss and maybe have some thoughts on. It's been discussed in other contexts, but generally results in a general proposal to give it further consideration and see if there isn't some way to change the way in which this profession is capitalized, in essence, because that, I think, is what we're talking about here. We have, we used to have, not all that many years ago, a Big Ten who became a Big Five, now a Big Four, but became a Big Five through a series of mergers and accumulated economies of scale in that process, and that is when the industry really bifurcated, I think, and there's a tremendous bridge to cross, and I think perhaps an uncrossable barrier now between the Big Four and those who comprise the rest of the industry, and it has primarily to do with capital. I mean, the key to being a Big Four and being competitive as a Big Four firm is the global presence, which we talked about in the earlier context, having the need to have industry and subject matter expertise across a vast array of areas, and IT infrastructure and a lot of the capital expenditures involved to maintain an enterprise of that nature. And as Lynn has and Pete have so well noted, these are partnerships at the end of the day, and there is something perhaps of a disconnect between the manner in which a partnership enterprise manages its balance sheet and the way the enterprise needs to function, the financial resources it needs to have at its disposal. So one thing I hope we'll have a chance to talk about, if not today, at another time, is whether and how to introduce the possibility, and it may be that it falls here with the PCAOB, but there'll be a lot of other interested parties and stakeholders, but the possibility that public accounting firms be permitted or encouraged to organize in corporate form and raise capital, as corporations do, from third parties, from outside sources, strengthen their balance sheet, provide a cushion that clearly doesn't exist today, and perhaps through that process to provide opportunities for other providers to become more competitive. I think there's an issue there that really requires some serious consideration.
Damon Silvers.
Yeah. I mean, like Lynn, I was a participant in the Treasury panel that had a number of recommendations and engaged in very extensive discussions on these issues. I think there's a couple of takeaways from that process that broadly that I think are important. I don't think it's a panacea, and this again may go to some other people's comments, but I think putting some independent voices into the firm governance is certainly would be an improvement in our major audit firms. Secondly, I think that having financial statements and having those statements accessible to the board and accessible to investors, it just seems kind of like common sense to me. I think the notion that these institutions are private entities in any meaningful sense is absurd. Effectively, the way we discuss the systemic risks associated with the failure of any given one of them tells us that they're really no longer private entities in any meaningful way. And therefore, the notion that their financials should be secret seems to me indefensible. That being said, I'm not sure I fully agree with Lynn that the financials of the audit firms are that important. The fact that their secrecy is indefensible doesn't necessarily mean that you really learn that much important from them. As Lynn alluded to, Arthur Andersen collapsed not because a giant liability appeared on his balance sheet, but because all its clients ran away when it got indicted. And I think that tells us something about what audit firms really are, which is not a collection of financial assets in any meaningful sense, but a reputation and a collection of human capital. That being said, the private litigation system in relation to audit firms does fulfill a limited but useful function, which is one of kind of deterrence. And I think there's lots of evidence over the years that private litigants, for better or for worse, are very measured in relation to their demands on audit firms, with the occasional exception of the sort of non-traditional party, the sort of business actor looking to score a giant score in some one-off situation. The final observation I make about these matters, about governance matters, is that I'm deeply skeptical. In fact, I would say more than skeptical, outright opposed to converting audit firms as partnerships into public corporations or into the corporate form. There's a lot of debate right now about whether, in fact, our stock brokerages, our investment banks, were pushed significantly in the direction of our current financial disaster as a result of their conversion from partnerships to public corporations. I think while the two entities are very different, I think there's something sort of going on behind there, which is that the partnership and the sort of the thinness of the distance between the institution and the individual professionals involved in it, it's a structure that in some ways is an attempt to embody the notion that this is a professional association and not a profit maximizing enterprise at some level. I'm not suggesting that's exactly how these firms were always managed. But it embodies an aspiration that I think it's very dangerous to walk away from, and I'm certain that we would not obtain the public goods that we are essentially asking audit firms to deliver were they to be organized as private profit maximizing enterprises.
Joe Carcello.
A couple of points. I wanted to briefly respond to Tony's point about the $4 million audit fee and the $1 million audit fee, and kind of like to know which one was right. I don't know if you'll ever know unequivocally which one was right, but for the benefit of the investors in the room, I have a suggestion. It may not be a great use of your time, but you can run CompuStat on size and industry, And if most of the companies in the same industry at the same, approximately the same size, are at 4 million, then you probably have your answer, right? If most of them are at 1 million, you probably have your answer. It's not perfect, but you could get a rough approximation based on public data, and that's one of the benefits of the SEC's rule, I guess, probably when you were there, Lynn, with Arthur, that disclosure, which I think is very valuable. There was a brief discussion earlier about transparency reports. I think Ann Simpson mentioned it. I would point out that, and I think it's to their credit, I don't know if the SEC and the PCAOB have seen it, but Deloitte has voluntarily published a transparency report this year. It's the only Big Four firm in the United States to have done that. I'm sure there's always room for improvement, but it's their first shot, and they did it voluntarily, and I think they need to be publicly praised for that. In terms of some of the things we've discussed, I would reinforce those who have spoken in favor of audit quality indicators. I think the motivation behind that at ACAP is right on target. If you have, and I would not recommend one, because if you have one indicator, the firms will just manage to that indicator. But if you have a series of indicators, 10, 15, 20, and no one indicator is going to be perfect, but I think you could come up with a series of indicators that most people would say are at least directionally consistent with improving audit quality. And if you had those and you annually published some portion of them, not all 20 every year, so the firms would not know which ones you're going to publish, sort of like SAS 99 introduced an element of unpredictability. So you publish some of them every year. The firms will pay attention to those, and to the extent they're good proxies for audit quality, will work to improve their firm's performance on those measures because it'll be public. I think I remember Damon talking about this. I believe it was Damon. In the New York Times, pick it up, or Forbes picks it up, or Fortune, Business Week, whatever. Audit committees will look at it, and it will affect hiring behavior, so it'll affect firm behavior. I can speak directly to this. I've seen what this does in universities, these university rankings, which are ubiquitous. And let me tell you guys, provosts, chancellors, deans, parents, students, for all of their warts, and there's lots of warts associated with them, they pay attention to them. And it does affect odd behavior inside universities. And unlike Big Four accounting firms, which may gain and lose clients, at the end of the day, we're a state-supported university where, you know, we're going to get a certain percentage of the kids from the state of Tennessee regardless of how we do in those rankings. But it, even with that said, it affects our behavior, so I'm sure it would affect the behavior of the major accounting firms. Independent members on firm governing boards, I think, is a great idea. I think Ann talked about how it could be gamed in the U.K. I think Lynn has, in his written statement, not sure how effective this would be. The danger is you have independent members on firm governing boards who are independent. They're not part of the firm, but they're friendly to the senior management of the firm. That's the risk you have with corporations today, right? Social networks. Commissioner Glassman, when she was still at the SEC, talked about the risk of social networks. I think that's a very real risk. And so what I would suggest, if the board did go in this direction, that they would put in place that firms have independent members on firm governing boards, but that those independent members would select their replacements. So that over time, you reduce the influence of management on who are the independent members. It may take a while to get completely independent members on the boards, but I think it'd have some effect. And then I think the audit partner signature recommendation is a good recommendation as well, but I've spoken long enough.
Actually, let me turn to Judge Sporkin for one second, because, Judge, I know that you've recommended independent advisory boards as well, and Joe, and you pointed out as a priority, and maybe you can speak for a second on that, and then we'll turn to the others.
I've recommended independent advisory boards to the... Yeah, but you're talking now about the Arthur Andersen that started some time back. I think it's very important that there be audit firms get ventilated. I found that they are much too closed. They need to have, when they have a blown audit, they need to have some independents look at the blown audit and to find out what went wrong, what lessons are learned, and to make changes. Anderson, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but back in the was it 70s or so, might 70s, Dan, you might remember this, appointed an independent board, including Newt Minow and some other former chairman of the SEC and some other people, and it worked out well. And you see what happens when they abandon it. But there are other reasons for that. But the point is that you need the you need to open it up. You have to. They need to have someone outside that they can converse with and to be able to give them good advice. And it will work. Does anybody have it now? Any of the firms have it now? None? But then why did they abandon the...
Actually, Lynn, before we get to answering the judges, because we're a little bit behind schedule.
Right.
Kellen, why don't we go to you, Gus, and Tony? And then if you got an, we can think about that. If you got an answer, then you can answer the judge.
It's Kelvin Blake. I just wanted to say that I agree with Norman Harrison that we need to figure out some way to remove the barriers of these regional firms moving up to become the top five or the top six accounting firms. However, I agree with Damon that I don't know that we want to necessarily go the corporate route, because when you go the corporate route, the audit firm will then have a responsibility or a primary duty to the shareholders, and that duty will be to maximize profit. And my concern that is if the audit firm has to balance audit quality with maximizing profit, it may lead to a reduction in audit quality.
This is Gus Sauter. Just addressing two of the topics previously discussed. The first one about signing the audit report. I think that's a fine idea. Maybe with a little F, not a capital F. As Lynn pointed out earlier, the lead auditor already has the financial liability associated with putting their signature on there anyways. But you do have to ask yourself, well, why wouldn't they sign it? So that would be fine. To me, a bigger issue is really ensuring no conflict of interests. That there is an inherent conflict, I think, if you're trying to be the watchdog over somebody who happens to be paying you. And so I think that it's important that the board actually gets a policy statement from an auditor as to what types of clients they will hire, and that they've established a culture that will enforce that policy statement so that they're really maintaining an independence from those from the company that they're auditing.
Well, I think that's a very helpful suggestion. And after today's meeting, we're going to have to figure out what the follow-up is. Clearly, one follow-up issue would be, from my perspective, how do we deal with conflicts of interest? And so maybe we'll chat with you, toss that back at your lap, and if you can come back with some specific recommendations, dealing with how do we deal with conflicts, I think that would be appreciated. Tony?
Yeah, I just wanted to just very briefly comment. Since both of these comments have to do with the fact that I also, while running my consulting firm, have been a member of the faculty at some very good schools for a little more than 16 years. So I did a little bit of work on empirical research, and I can't say that I've ever changed my mind and the opinions about the accuracy of CompuStat. I think it's non-existent. I don't rely on any studies that say anything about stuff that's coming from CompuStat. I'm sorry? Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was about university rankings. I've never seen anything more farcical than MBA rankings. I don't think I'm overstating it. There are two very simple things. One, how many schools do people who vote on those things attend? Do you get an MBA from more than one school? Why are these things considered comparative? The other point is, at one of the universities that I went to, I was there for about 2 years. The first year that I was there, the school fell from the top 10 ranking to number 12. The dean called the statistics department and said, I want you guys to sit down and in one day come up with everything that's wrong with the way these rankings are calculated. And they wrote a letter. The next year, they went back into the top 10, and the head of the statistics department asked the same dean, would you like me to write another letter this year?
I just want to thank Commissioner Walter, who has to leave at the moment. We very much appreciate your being here. It's important to us.
It was lovely to be here with all of you, and I hope to see you all again soon.
Tony, I'm sorry, we got you now.
If you promise not to tell, they laugh about me and call me an accounting group.
Stay that way. Anne?
Just very quickly, I wanted to echo support for the audit partner signature. Bob, you spoke earlier about the power of the CEO and CFO certification, and I think it's the same in this space. And I think it would make a huge difference in terms of having that signature. I wanted to make a few comments about the need for audited financials. We debated this quite extensively at the Treasury Department about whether they should be public or not. At a minimum, I don't see how the PCAOB can do its job, frankly, without seeing them. And frankly, I think audit committees should also have them. I think it should be part of the required communications at the very least provided from the audit firm to the audit committees. At a minimum, there should be at least some form of a truncated annual report that's available to the public. I think at least some financial information should be included. I think information about the firm's governance, the affiliate structure, a lot of the items that were discussed by prior folks, and also the audit quality indicators. And I guess I'd like to leave that issue at your doorstep. I mean, we discussed that quite a bit again at the Treasury Department, and as you might remember from the report, we're not very specific. We sort of said, let the PCAOB decide what those are, because we didn't really have great ideas about what are the perfect audit quality indicators. But I would urge the PCAOB to really think about that, because ultimately that's what's most important, I think, for financial statement users.
Mike.
I know a lot of people have said the same thing, but I do think the audit quality indicators are one of the more important things in this category, because of how that will be reacted to by the firms. And then my last thought, which I always hate throwing out ideas that seem somewhat impractical, but I feel like I need to throw one out, because one of the inherent problems that has been alluded is that the auditing firms, even though we went a long way with independence and reporting to the audit committee, and technically the audit committee is hiring with shareholders ratifying the firms, the funds that are paying and their client still tends to be the company. And without turning it into a regulatory environment, is there a vision at some point in time where there would be a fee assessment of the publicly traded companies to create a pool, and an organization like the PCAOB actually hiring the firms to perform the audits of the financial statements? And that feels so radical a statement to me, it's hard for me to say it. But you won't ever get true independence and true clear delineation of who's the boss and whose rules are they going to follow till you follow, as they say, when you follow the money, that's where, and the money's still coming from the corporations. So there's an inherent problem that we're trying to mitigate here, even though I'm not a big proponent of fee assessment and managing that whole process. It's an idea.
Mike, you're now a wanted man. Bob?
Thanks, Steve. Bob Tirola. I just want to thank Ann Yeager for explaining all the things that she thinks ought to be done, because I agree with her 100%. But I want to add two personal notes to that. One is, I signed about 1,000 audit opinions in my career. The first time I signed an officer certification, I really worried. It's a different feeling when you're signing your own name. Secondly, that officer certification goes much farther than an audit opinion. And I would encourage the board to take a look at it as a model of what we should ask auditors to be doing, not hiding behind GAAP, looking for fairly stated, unequivocally, addressing fraud, addressing controls. That's all in the officer certification, yet we let the auditors get away with a lot less.
Lynn, you want to have the last word on this panel? I'm sorry, Brandon. I apologize. And Meredith, Barbara. And then we've got until 2:30, so 15 more minutes, and we'll go on to the next one.
My word will be short. It's just to agree with Damon and Kelvin that going from partnerships to publicly held companies is fraught with risk and needs to be done very carefully if you were to go that way, for the capital and other reasons that Norman highlighted. There may be reasons to try and expand the scope, but the change from partnership to public company has a cultural implication that I think you can't underestimate. And also to agree with Bob that I think that the signature and the certification process, I had the same experience. Admittedly, it was the difference between signing legal opinions and signing officer certificates. But I do think it's a very real difference.
We certainly appreciate those, or at least I appreciate those comments. I mean, and one of the reasons to have the investor advisory group is to hear directly from investors, because you often don't have the time or the resources to comment on a lot of these issues. And therefore, I think that your views are very important to get on a record. Because the overwhelming comment letters on the engagement partner signature were opposed to it, and they came primarily from the profession. And so hearing a number of your views on that is important in terms of creating a record. But moving down the table, Meredith, do you want to go next?
I'm happy to, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Mike lighting the fire. I'll throw the grenade in. And I have to use Mike's word, inherent. I think there is an inherent conflict anytime you have relationships that involve one party paying another for a service, and that service and that relationship is measured in decades, if not centuries. So my thought is you rotate them. You get a 5-year deal if you perform. You throw them out, bring in a new team. Throw them out, bring in a new team. I feel very strongly about that. I've practiced that for 20 years with a number of professional service providers, all of them partnership kinds of firms. I'm convinced that every firm providing a professional service, and I don't care if it's a dentist, an actuary, an investment advisor, an accounting firm, has a unique and valued perspective. And if you're not going to rotate, you better bring someone in to look over their shoulder every several years. It keeps everybody on their toes. It's expensive. It's darned expensive. That first year of a 5-year accounting deal, it's a killer to the auditee, and it's a killer to the audit firm. They're not making any money. They make out like bandits in the fifth year, no doubt about it. But overall, there's probably some additional cost, but I think there's huge, huge value in having a rotation of those different perspectives. It's a huge value to the auditee, whether it's me as a pension plan, whether it's someone else as a corporate entity. I know it's a wonderful thing for me. I bitch about it, 24/7 when we've got a new auditor in. But you know, when it's over with, after that first year, I can step back and say, you know what, we've been going down this path, and they shed some light on some things that we're doing, that makes a lot of sense, and I think we're better because of it. I feel really strongly about that. I know it's very radical, but I think it certainly has worked for us in a number of areas. I think it could work for the corporate world as well. Thanks.
Well, Bonnie, we haven't heard from you, and then we'll go to Damon, then we'll go to Lynn. And Lynn, you know, you're both from Colorado, you and Meredith, so you can talk about the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and rotation of auditors and the political implications of that particular issue. Not that a lot of people would disagree with you, Meredith, but, you know, that issue is certainly...
Mr. Chairman...
We'll look forward to the Colorado contingent handling
Mr.
that.
Chairman, I'm not talking about partners.
No, neither were we in terms of the Sarbanes-Oxley, but the two of you can fly home together and think the great thoughts on the way to the Sky High State. Bonnie?
Bonnie Hill. And I was interested in Meredith's comments. One, because when a public company changes auditors, the street says, uh-oh, something's wrong, what's going on? And then, you know, the board is put on the defense again. So I'm not opposed to that idea, but I think it would certainly have to be made very clear that that's the policy of the board. The other thing is it is pretty disruptive in terms of the work that has to be done within the company and the auditing team and the finance team and all of that. So I really would suggest you look at that very a public company, look at it very carefully, because you change the audit partner every 5 years or so, but to change the whole company just because of a policy might not be the best way to go. And I think in terms of the cost to the shareholders and the disruption to the company, have to make sure it's worth it.
Damon Silvers.
The thing about some of these issues is that Steve, as you were alluding to, we all have a certain history to them, and some of them have been, I think, discussed and advocated by investors for so long that some of us begin to forget the list of things we're advocating, perhaps get discouraged. So in my prior comments, I didn't mention these two matters that have since come up that I think are both wise. One I think small and almost trivial, but yet, you know, savagely resisted by the audit profession, which is to have the audit partner identify who they are. Something which, I mean, those of us in the legal profession know that, you know, every SEC filing is signed by an attorney, not by a firm, but by a person. And so I don't get it. But that seems like small potatoes compared to Meredith's point, which just reminds me again, going back to, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley and the like, that this was, that firm rotation was and still is, I think, something that investors have advocated for. And I want to go at it from a somewhat different perspective than the ones that Meredith laid out, which I agree with. We have a big problem, and we wrestled with it on the ACAP. It's funny, I can never keep that acronym, and it's, you know, in my head. When we wrestled with at great length, Bonnie and I in particular, on the competition subcommittee. Of, you know, a market for audit services for large firms, it's extraordinarily concentrated in the big four, and which gives rise to the systemic risk issues associated with the potential failure of any one of those firms, and the like. Seems to me that for some of the reasons Bonnie alluded to, in the current regime. Changing for a firm to change for an issuer to change audit firms sends all sorts of signals to the marketplace that nobody wants to send, and that then you have to spend a lot of time running around and interpreting what you're doing and the like, and nobody may ever really fully believe you. They'll keep asking, you know, investors and journalists will keep asking, you know, well, tell me really why are you doing this and so forth. And it's not just that leads to the type of sort of embedded relationships that Meredith was talking about. It's that I think it's an obstacle to developing a more competitive market. I think it makes it more difficult for there to be processes and entry points for firms that are aspiring. And we all know what these firms are. There's a couple of firms that potentially could play for the larger, you know, for the larger audit clients. I think it makes it more difficult for those firms to do so. I think it makes it more difficult for anyone thinking about, you know, could you do a roll-up of some kind? Could you put together a viable competitor? To think about then, you know, how would you compete? What would you go after? If there was structured rotations without sort of sinister implications, I think that would be a significant piece of encouragement to seeing some improvement on the competitiveness side as well.
Okay, I'll just limit my comments to the last topic that's just been discussed, and I'll probably be maybe in the minority around this table, but having been in the shoes of an auditor, the rotation idea, I do think it's been helpful in terms of rotating partners within firms. I think that for a whole host of reasons, going back to segregation of duties, going back to some things that have been talked around about this table, that it comes down to the quality of the audit partner, you know, very often to put it all together. The challenge, because I definitely agree we could get more independent audits by rotating firms, and then you'd get the ultimate independence. But I'm not sure with large global enterprises, particularly the most complex beasts that we've been talking about today, the list that Lynn went down of effectively failed enterprises through the last crisis, for a firm to come in and get up to speed, particularly given the fact that we're in a constant reporting cycle, so we don't stop the mill, quarters are going out, you know, while a new audit firm's coming in, getting up to speed. I think we're going to go that route as a country and an economy, that we'd want to be very, very thoughtful about how we did it and how we deal with the transitions and so forth. Not saying, again, there's a right or wrong answer, but it just, I'd slow us down a little bit in terms of just how hard it is to get up to speed on these things. And the fact that at the end of the day, you want one person, everybody wants one person to sign the audit opinion, for one person to get up to speed on General Motors or on JP Morgan Chase is just a mind-boggling exercise, even with the help of hundreds of people in their firm.
Very briefly, CalPERS is huge, as you all know, $200 billion plus. But is required by law locally to rotate its auditors every 5 years and is not allowed to reappoint the existing firm. It can only give a 5-year contract. So there is some experience with large financial institutions. Maybe we should look at that. The other thing I just wanted to say, as you were asking for comments for the record, that I don't think I said specifically, but CalPERS does support the recommendations in the ACAP report, and I want to highlight the audit engagement partner's signature is something that would certainly add value for this person doing the signing as much as for the readers of the accounts.
Three things, Steve. First of all, the issue of capital and only four firms. About 10 to 12 years ago, the profession looked at alternative firm structures. Some firms adopted them, but quite frankly, they never worked out for any of the firms. And some of the firms now regret having gone into those structures. If you look at the size of the regional firms, again, if you go and look at the number of offices, number of people, the capital in them, there is no way possible for any of those to grow up into another big four. So we are stuck with the too few to fail. That's the reality of it. There's nothing you can do. So to do this, to say we're going to raise capital, create competition, is a gross misnomer. It will never happen. It can't happen. We have let it get so dominated by this oligarchy that we're stuck with it for this point in time until someone has got the guts, quite frankly, to go do a breakup. And that's and even then, the firms don't generate the type of rate of return that you'd expect in a public company. So they couldn't raise the public capital because, quite frankly, they aren't going to generate the type of returns you'd really want to see there to start with. That's the first point. Second point, someone raised the question about
can you really get information out of the financials of these? The answer is yes. You can see what liquidity is looking like in these firms and cash flows. You can look at what their calls on their cash is and what they're having to use the cash up for, including the revolver. You can turn around and, most importantly, look and see what they're spending on and investing in two key components, one technology and one people. If you ever manage one of these units, and I did manage them inside the firm, there are very key components as far as what you're spending on people out of every revenue dollar, what you're generating in revenue dollar per people. It tells you how much you're leveraging up the people. It tells you whether or not you're putting your money where you need to make sure that you're getting the job done right. That information is available in those financials and only available in those financials, so it's very important you get that. On the last point, rotation. It did used to be that there was a negative connotation with changing auditors, but in the last half dozen years, thousands of companies have changed auditors, and that's no longer the case. Analysts have gotten so used to seeing a change in auditor, it's a natural, they ask a question about it, you tell them, and it's over. It doesn't have the negative connotation, nothing close to what it used to. And if you go to a mandatory rotation, say like every 10 years, then in fact, everyone knows what it is. So that argument is set aside. Furthermore, it's extremely expensive for the firms to rotate the audit partner every 5 years, especially on the big companies, because you got these partners you have to move around all the time and stage them, so it becomes very expensive for the firms. And quite frankly, I've never seen one of those partners stand up and say, let's change our financial statements from what we were doing as a firm before, because they know that that results in litigation and a suit. So I don't think you get a whole lot on partner rotation. So I am a strong supporter of what Damon says in terms of mandatory rotation. There was a recent excellent article in CFO Magazine where a number of CFOs talked about how they were changing auditors and changing to get lower fees. And what was interesting in the article is not one of them, well, they all talked about how great a job they'd done, and Bonnie, it was how great a job the CFO was doing, not the audit committee, in getting those lower fees, okay? Not a single one of them turned around and complained about the cost of changing auditors. Not a single one of them.
What you haven't addressed, though, and what hasn't been addressed, is the whole issue of competition with mega organizations. You know, if you've been through an auditor or two and the one left has your competitor, not going there. There's no confidence.
Yeah, I chaired
that's something that has to
I chaired a Fortune 200, Fortune 150 size company's audit committee, and you always just make sure you keep one clean, and you can do it.
Keep one clean, yeah.
Keep one clean.
Well, I think now we'd like to turn to the next panel, which is the greater transparency of the audit process. And Bill, I'd like to turn that over to you.
Thank you, Steve. We've been talking about audit firms and now want to shift to talking about the audit process. Really, I think it's a matter that has been discussed quite a bit today, but the objective of this next panel perhaps is to put a little extra focus on the audit process by pulling back the veil, if you will, and trying to more specifically identify what should be disclosed and who should disclose it, and more specifically, what is the role of the PCAOB in that disclosure. Our designated hitters to get us started are Kelvin Blake, Norman Harrison, and Bonnie Hill, and the first up to bat is Kelvin.
Thank you. Given the limited time we have here, I wanted to focus my comments on achieving greater transparency in the auditor's report. I'll then turn it over to Bonnie and Norman to share their comments. The current auditor's report is not very transparent and provides the financial statement user with very little information into the audit process and the underlying financial statements. The current reporting model has been in existence since the 1930s with very little change and is considered by many to be a pass-fail model or a boilerplate model. I believe that the standard report should be changed to provide greater transparency to the investing public. I believe the report should be revised in two ways. One, I think the report needs to be expanded to include informative disclosures relating to both the auditor's responsibilities and the audit process itself. Second, I believe the report should be written in more plain English. I've shared the auditor's report with some of my colleagues who are actually attorneys, and they have a difficult time understanding what the report is actually saying. First, I think that the auditor's report should be expanded to include a discussion of the auditor's responsibilities regarding detecting fraud during the audit process and the limitations that the auditor faces in detecting fraud. I believe a big part of the expectations gap that exists between the financial statement users and the auditing profession comes from the fact that the users believe that the auditors should be detecting all types of fraud, whereas it's clear from the under the current standards, auditors are responsible for searching for fraud, but they're not necessarily going to find that fraud because a lot of fraud is basically caused by management acting in collusion and is hidden from the auditors. I also believe that the auditor's report should be expanded to include a discussion of the materiality issues that auditors face and both the qualitative and quantitative issues that the auditors face when conducting audits. Materiality is determined by what an auditor believes would have changed or influenced the judgment of a reasonable financial statement user. Given that the auditor is relying upon what he or she believes a reasonable financial statement user would determine to be material, I think that should be disclosed to the financial statement user. I think the report should discuss generally the qualitative factors that are considered in an audit and for the particular audit in question, the existence or the absence of such factors. In addition, the auditor's report should discuss the quantitative materiality levels set by the auditor and used in planning evidence accumulation and in determining whether the financial statements as a whole are materially misstated. What basis did the auditor use in determining materiality, net income before taxes, total assets? What percentage of the basis was determined to be material? 5% of net income before taxes, 10%? For comparability purposes, I believe it is relevant whether the auditor set materiality at 4% of NIBT, net income before taxes, versus 6%. Finally, I believe the PCAOB should consider expanding the auditor's report to include a discussion of the significant accounting principles used by management, significant estimates made by management, and the key risk factor areas identified by the auditors. While some of this information may be, in fact, disclosed in the financial statement notes, I believe it's often overlooked by the investor. And finally, I want to discuss plain English. Regardless of whether the auditor's report is expanded to include the disclosures that I've just mentioned, I think the report needs to be written in plain English. Currently, the report uses a lot of accounting terminology that is not easily understood by the non-accountants. I would imagine that the average investor does not know what it means for an auditor to plan and perform the audit to obtain reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements are free of material misstatement. For example, is it clear to the average investor that reasonable assurance does not mean that the auditor is not guaranteeing the financial statements are without material misstatement? Does the reasonable assurance terminology provide the financial statement user with the level of assuredness provided by the audit? Does the average investor know what constitutes a material misstatement, or that materiality is determined based upon the auditor's perception of what the reasonable investor would find material? Is it clear to the average investor that examining on a test basis means that the auditor is testing only a sampling of the transactions and then projecting that sampling onto the entire class of transactions or the account balance? Thank you.
I think I'm next, Steve. This is Norman Harrison. Kelvin's done a very good job of laying out the framework. I'll just expand on a couple of points, and then I'm going to take the liberty of pulling forward the independence issue, which we touched on in the last panel, but I think it has some relevance here that I'd like to include in the discussion. You know, we perhaps overly glorify the
the end product of the auditor's work by calling it a report. It is, in effect, a letter. I was reminiscing with some colleagues at dinner last night that, you know, way back when I was an undergraduate in business school and then went through my first job in New York as a young analyst and began to study financial statements and then went to law school and learned about due diligence. You know, back in those days, it was customarily a three-paragraph letter, and if you got to the 10-K or got to the annual report and you opened the get to the page and it was a three-paragraph letter, you just turned the page and kept reading, because only if there was a fourth paragraph or some additional language in there you didn't expect to see did you stop and actually, did the red light go off and did you stop and read it. We haven't advanced very much since then. It's still a highly formulaic report, a lot of boilerplate language, as Kelvin noted. And I think that when the investor community thinks about what would be beneficial in terms of greater disclosure around the process of conducting the audit, we mean a real report, an actual narrative description of the approach that the firm took to this particular engagement for this particular year. How was it staffed? What were the resources the firm deemed necessary to contribute to the team? What was the audit plan? What framework did they follow in conducting the audit? What technical expertise or subject matter experts within the firm, not necessarily by name, but by function, did they draw upon and why? And I think perhaps most importantly, to tie into to Kelvin's comments, a discussion of the principal financial risks that the company faces and which the auditors took into account in designing their audit plan and, importantly, in developing their measures or standards of materiality, because risk and materiality are hand in hand, and I think a well-crafted audit report would describe both of those at an appropriate level of detail and explain how they interconnected in terms of the actual conduct of the audit. Another area where I think it would be helpful to have more disclosure, we've talked in other contexts today about the on-off switch or the toggle switch nature of a lot of what the auditors render an opinion on, in connection both with financial risk and with the connection with the evaluation of internal control processes. Even in those situations in which no material weakness is found to exist, I think it would be very helpful from an investor standpoint to have some narrative discussion of issues that were identified, or perhaps emerging trends or emerging areas of concern that, while still short of a material weakness, may be headed in that direction and may require some attention on the part of the issuer. And I think knowing that the auditor identifies those and disclosed those or urged management to pay attention to those would be something that the investors in capital markets would be well served by understanding. I think also in the current environment, given in particular the events of the past 2 years, I think some discussion or disclosure of the degree of regulatory risk an enterprise faces would be a very helpful addition to an auditor's report. And then lastly, a word on independence, because it is certainly a governance issue, but the independence determination is essential to the conduct of the audit, because it is the threshold decision to be made at the outset as to whether or not the firm is actually competent to conduct the audit for the year in question. I think that it would be extremely useful, and you know, we are again in an environment in which audit firms are providing a wide array of services to their clients. Everyone is back in the consulting business through the advisory practices. Many cases are providers of significant amounts of tax service to their clients. We have the benefit of bodies of rules and regulations, importantly, most importantly through the PCAOB, but in addition through the SEC, that we didn't have the last round of financial frauds. I think the next logical step here is to require disclosure to investors of the process by which the independence determination was made, because I think we're back in an environment where there certainly are, in many instances, some close calls. And it would be helpful to know, to have a description of the firm's internal engagement acceptance process with respect to the specific engagement in question, the steps the firm took to measure and determine its independence, and importantly, discussion of any issues that came up, both internally as the firm vetted the engagement, and perhaps even more importantly, in discussions with the audit committee. What questions were raised, what potential compromises to independence were identified, and on what factual basis were they resolved? And I think that would also, Steve and other members of the board, I think that would be important information to better inform your inspection process as you go in and examine independence processes that the firm is following. So those are my highlights or seeds to sow for further discussion, and with that I'll turn it over to Bonnie, who will provide the customer, the client's perspective.
Okay, Bonnie Hill here. My colleagues have said it all. I'm neither an accountant nor a lawyer, and I'm not going to try to be either. And so when I started looking at the topics that we had on hand, my first question was, who cares and why do they care? Why does it matter? And what's my role in all of this? And why do I need to know it? And I thought about the fact that, you know, when we look at shareholders and what they come into in terms of their investments, it's that they want to know, one, whether it's worth their putting their monies into a particular organization, if that organization is well run. Is this a good investment for me? Are the financial statements clean? Who's overseeing the process? How are they doing it? And so those are the things that matter, and it matters to shareholders. And we talk about shareholders. We have people here representing sort of large investors, and yet and still we talk about more transparency, greater disclosure. And sometimes what that means is much more paper, more legal jargon, and more accounting jargon. And so the average investor, the mom and pop who puts their money into an organization, can't begin to make anything out of all those disclosures. So when we make the disclosures, when we talk about plain English, does that mean more is better? And I think not. I think it means that perhaps we have two different audiences, and we have the financial markets that need to see one thing and need a great deal of disclosure and insight, and then we have the sort of small investor who really wants to understand what it is he or she is reading. And so the plain English to me goes to the sort of smaller investor, because those of you here and around the table, you don't need a lot of plain English. You know exactly what you're reading. You've already demonstrated that, you know, in discussions around the table. So it becomes a question of how do we disclose the information that needs to be there. As a director, you know, and the one for which the blame goes to when something isn't disclosed in the way people think it should be, then I do want to know. I do want to question, particularly in the boardroom, how the auditors have gotten to where they got. What have they seen that they won't disclose to me as a director? I want to know how to get to that, and I want to know the process that they use. And it's very interesting. I think last night, or with our group, our team, I was saying that, you know, when I was on audit committees, the question I would ask at the end of the meetings is, okay, what would you have asked if you were sitting in my seat that I have not thought to ask, or any of us have not thought to ask? And the amazing thing is that on more than one occasion, we had an auditor to say, well, I think I would want to know. And I'm, you know, my question was, why didn't I come out without me asking the stupid question? And it's probably, I won't speculate, but I will speculate, because a lot of times people don't want to come out. They don't know if a director really wants to know the good, the bad, and the dirty. And so I think there are times when the director in the boardroom really has to push the auditor and make certain that the auditor has the comfort level in terms of saying what he or she sees. And then in terms of transparency, I think definitely that in our annual reports, an overview of how the auditor has proceeded with his or her work is important, and how the board uses that. But I think if it can be done concisely and in a readable fashion for the average person, that would make a tremendous difference. And we sort of joked last evening about the fact that maybe what we're looking at are two annual reports, two sets of disclosures, one for the average person like me and one for all the really smart people like you guys. And that's, I think with that, I wanted to save us some time, and I didn't really have a lot to say so that we could have a discussion.
Over to Marty, he's done a lot of work in the standards in this area. I know, Gus, you know, you indicated this was a priority, and you had some comments, and I'd like to, because we are, to a certain extent, we are creating a record here, I'd like you to give us, you know, the comments that you had. And then, Pete, you also mentioned it as a priority. and I'd like to get your comments and any others as well. You know, on the SAG, we've got some of the comments of the other members who are here, but we would welcome others. But Gus, since we haven't heard from you before on this issue, and Pete, since we haven't heard before from you on this issue, why don't we do that now? And then since Marty and the standards has been doing a lot of work and has vetted this issue a little bit, I'd like to turn it over to him.
Great. Thanks, Steve. This is Gus Sauter speaking. There are two items that I'd like to talk about. The first one is what I'll call the distance from the cliff. It seems like the audit is, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay, oops, it's a qualified opinion. And there's really not much of an indication of how close to the edge of the cliff you are all along the process. And clearly, of the audits that are clean, quote-unquote clean, there have to be differences. There has to be a range. And so we think that there should be some comment within the audit letter as to things that should be considered. It could be in the form of a checklist that's perhaps presented in an appendix, things like the types of modeling that were done to determine the value of assets, you know, perhaps a listing of contingent liabilities. So there was discussion earlier about SPVs, and here I'm a little bit torn between what's the domain of FASB versus the PCOB. But if the auditors could say, we think that there's risk here with contingent liabilities or SPVs, that would be very helpful. So, again, just perhaps a checklist for some indication as to how close a firm might be from a qualified opinion as opposed to just pass-fail. Another point, a little bit different slant from some of the other comments, as opposed to the financial risk of a firm, or the investment risk of a firm, I think we would appreciate discussion as to the risk of the audit itself. So there, certainly within an audit, there are many things that are identified that are not risky. I mean, you know for certain what they are. Cash, you know what cash is. But then there are other items, items that might involve fair value accounting, where there's a wide range of potential estimation error. And what we need as analyzers of the financial statements is some help trying to figure out where we should focus the bulk of our time. We need to know that a certain method was used to estimate values of certain types of assets and focus on those, so we're not wasting time on the straightforward issues. Fair value accounting is obviously fraught with estimation error. As I mentioned earlier when we were talking about the fraud center. On average, the financial statements can depict the financial value of a firm, but there's risk around that average, and we need to know where those areas are. So help within the audit report as to where to go to find, to focus on those risks would be beneficial.
Yeah, those are great comments, Gus. I share a lot of those, and I guess the comment that I had submitted in writing was along the lines of, again, of the pass-fail, that the idea that you can spend hundreds of thousands of professional hours on some of these large engagements on an annual basis and come back with a boilerplate opinion that's exactly the same, no matter whether, again, just as long as you're not going over the cliff, it's virtually exactly the same. And, you know, the firms, I don't think, are doing that to be obtuse. They're doing that because that's the standards they have to follow. I also think it's because of, again, the litigious environment we're in, that, you know, any time that they would get out of any kind of a comfort zone, they're putting themselves at great risk. So how do we solve for both of those? You know, the idea that there's a tremendous amount of knowledge and intellectual capital built up amongst the members of the audit team that could be shared in some fashion, but how you protect them from the legal risk of, you know, a lot of the stuff is still judgmental. At the end of the day, their judgments could be off. Hopefully, they're not 180 degrees off. That, you know, they're somewhere in the 360 degree radius. That they're probably going to be 20 to 25 degrees of right or wrong. That's going to be a lot closer if they can kind of talk to us about that than if we just have to guess. So, and I'm mindful of the fact there are other organizations out there that provide their opinions on companies and their financial stability or their credit rating. So, obviously, the big credit rating agencies have a very finely graded type of a granulated type of grading system. So, you know, AAA, AAA minus, double, you know, triple B plus. So you go through what S&P, a Moody's, or a Fitch. You know, do we want to get something like that from the audit firms? Do we come up with, again, I like Gus's idea of maybe a little bit of a checklist of, you know, what are the kind of things, particularly the soft spots, the estimates, and, again, be able to get some color on not only what management's views were, how they're coming up with the estimates, but what's the auditor's judgment, you know, beyond a pass-fail of, did they, you know, just, again, pass? You know, what are the various gradations of pass and fail is so rare it's almost not even worth talking about because it's rare that, you know, anybody comes back and fails, it gets a qualified opinion. There's got to be something in between.
Yeah.
That's very helpful. Lynn Turner?
I actually have a different view. I actually do like the pass-fail system. When I pick up a financial statement... when I pick up a financial set of financial statements, I want to know they're either right or wrong. I don't want to know that cash is right and receivables is okay, you know, and that when I get down to impairment of assets, it's like, oh God, who knows? So I think that a pass-fail notion is a good notion, and I think it's the right way to go with the report. What I would then build on top of that, though, is what we discussed at the SAG, and that is something that has been labeled as an auditor's discussion or analysis of the numbers. And the things that Gus is asking for actually exist, because when we do an audit... at the end of the day, at end of each audit, there is some type of summary memo prepared that goes on top of the binder that every single partner and the concurring partner and the audit manager have to sign off on. And what that memo does is it identifies the significant items that the auditor was concerned about that had risk. And any of us that have done those audits know exactly what memo we're talking about, okay? Now, if we knew that was going to become public, we might be a lot more careful how we write it or write it in a different context. But what you're asking for does exist. It's that summary memo that is in every single audit. And that's, in essence, what would go into an auditor's discussion or an analysis. Part of what you're asking for, though, is also not an auditing issue. Part of what you're asking for deals with the FASB's disclosure standards. And the FASB's own investor technical advisory committee has urged the FASB to adopt a disclosure framework. And that disclosure framework, if they would do it, would turn around and provide investors the key assumptions that go into these significant judgments and estimates. It would give you information about the range of possible outcomes and the key points that would drive, as well as what within that range was the number that the company picked. So if you still get a good number in the financial statement, what they think their best estimate was, but you get information in the footnotes about all the flavor and connotation around that so you can make estimates. You put that information together with then what's in that auditor memo, and I can guarantee you know exactly where the risks are in those financial statements, and you know exactly the information you need to dig down and analyze, and if you want to on your own move the numbers around, move them around. But that's what you're really trying to get to. And trying to put all that just into the first pass-fail audit report, I don't think works. I think I want to be able to just right off the bat go and say, are my financials right or not? And then go get the additional analysis so I can analyze it as a analyst or researcher or investor. But I still want that pass-fail report.
Yeah.
in plain English.
Marty, do you want to take a minute or two and, or a couple of minutes and discuss what we're up to?
Sure. This is Marty Bauman, the chief auditor at the PCAOB. And this has been a great discussion, and thanks. It's a valuable input to us in our auditing standard-setting process. So let me just talk about a couple of the things that have been discussed. The first one was, should the individual auditor sign the audit report? And as was mentioned a couple of times, we've discussed that with the standing advisory group. We issued a concept release on that. And what's particularly helpful here, because as Steve said, and the responses that came back to the concept release were largely from the profession and largely opposed to that concept of signing the report. Clearly, the discussion around this table from this investor group is sees that that's a pretty good way for accountability on the part of the auditor, and would probably help the investor and may even help the auditor as well, I think I heard somebody say. As we have a project underway in my office kind of pulling that sort of to its final conclusion right now, where we'll bring a paper to the board with our recommendation from the Office of the Chief Auditor as to how we should move ahead with that project on signing the audit report. And so the board should be getting that recommendation from my office pretty soon. And we've been doing a lot of, you know, research on that, and certainly this conversation of record helps that discussion. Turning to the auditor report itself, and Lynn, thanks for summarizing most of what I was going to say, because you did a great job. We had a very good discussion of this at the very last meeting of the SAG, just a month or two back. And it was a recommendation of the Treasury Advisory Committee, and so we took this up and put a briefing paper before the SAG and had a pretty very, very thorough discussion, including breakout sessions with members of the SAG. And I think what Lynn said was held pretty widely by most of the group, that there is a great benefit to the single report that does say whether or not the financial statements present fairly, that making that ambiguous might not be very helpful to investors, and therefore retaining the report that indicates whether the financials present fairly or not is a positive thing, but yet the auditors want more. So again, I have to come to a recommendation to the board, but in doing that, the way we're thinking about that is taking a look at, and pretty in line with the comments that Kelvin made initially, taking a look at the audit report itself, which would retain the presents fairly pass-fail type of model, but there's probably some things in the language of that report that could still be improved. And that might be a shorter-term project to deal with improving the language, which might deal with some of the responsibilities around fraud, as well as some of the other things you mentioned. What does reasonable assurance mean? And so on and so forth. So, but maybe staying with that report, improving that report, and clarifying some of the language in it and improving it. And a potentially longer-term project, because it's not quite as simple to take a look at what Lynn called and what has been referred to by many people as the auditor's discussion and analysis. And we'll, again, we'll make a recommendation to the board on how to proceed, how we think, my office thinks we should proceed on this. But there are a lot of communications that are made to the audit committee as well of the type of nature that investors are asking for here, right here. The close calls, consultations with national office, the most complicated estimates and judgments, the controversial accounting policies, things of those that nature that it really seems that investors are looking for that kind of information as well. Adding that supplementary auditor's discussion and analysis, I think, requires a lot more thought as to what that would look like, the standards around that, guidelines around that, et cetera. And we'll think of the best ways to try to address that, which, you know, could include focus groups and the like, to try to get further input on how that might be done. But that's been pretty consistent input in that regard. And I also agree that it's a project that probably needs to be coordinated to some extent with FASB, because a lot of this, when we're talking about measurement uncertainty, illiquid financial instruments, as an example, over the last couple of years, the ranges around those numbers can be quite large as to what that actual the financial instrument's value is. and the actual departure around what was reported in the financial statement and potential ranges around that might actually equal what the auditor considers to be material. And so disclosure of that somewhere in the financial statements so that investors understand that that number that they're looking at on the balance sheet might have a range around it that's equal to or greater than what the auditor considers to be material might be very important. So those are the kinds of things that I think we've begun some conversations with Bob Herz. I sit on the disclosure framework project task force there, and I think there is an integrated effort as well. So we are tackling these issues on the auditor's report, and these comments have been very, very helpful. So thank you.
Try and finalize this panel in the next 10 minutes or so.
Mike Head, and my intent here is to kind of reinforce a few things that have been said from my perspective is that I'm sort of where Lynn and the PC and Marty are, that I think it will cause confusion if you try to put a multi-page report in the 10K for the investor to look at as part of opining on the fair presentation of the financial statements and their accuracy. However, I do think the concept of an auditor discussion and analysis, like management's discussion and analysis, and having that as a section in the 10K could add a lot of value, and as we've already described a roll-up that already is in place from it being the audit conclusion documentation that auditors have to put together, how that supports the mandatory communications to the audit committee that covers most of these items, not all of them. And then if you draw upon their planning report that they present at the beginning of the year to the audit committee on, most of them call it their integrated audit plan, and you take elements, all of this information already exists, and if there was a format of and required content that's dictated similar to management's discussion and analysis, that would be the auditor's discussion and analysis, that the firm would have to sign a consent like they do the opinion, I think you add some real value and not create more audit work or cost to the audit, because it all already exists and has to be reported in some form or fashion to the audit committees today. It's just a matter of what's important to the user and reader of the financial statements from the PCAOB's and SEC's opinion. So, I think that's a very, very positive direction to go. That is where I think a lot of the dialogue today has been at.
Just very quickly, while certainly...
Ann Yerger, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, this is Ann Yerger. Certainly the council believes the disclosure about the auditing process would be of interest. We do believe that more details about key findings would be of particular benefit to the investing public. I'm aware that you've released a proposal regarding enhanced disclosures between the audit firms and the audit committees, and our view at the council is that some of those disclosures would be of keen interest to the investing public, and it seems like some of your work is already being done in this area, and Gus, I think it would get at some of the issues you were talking about, which I agree are very, very important.
Sorry, because Meredith, you had yours up first. We're just going in order. It's Anne Simpson at CalPERS. We're fully in support of more commentary.
Anne Simpson?
Yes.
Just identify yourselves as you go around, because there's a larger audience.
Right, thank you. I am Anne Simpson. one caveat, if the discussion is to be more than just more fluff, is this issue about potential liability litigation, and I don't know, well, maybe we just leave it on the table for coming back to discussion, is about what do we need by way of safe harbor provisions. So confidentiality is not quite the confessional confidentiality between the auditor and the audit committee, but putting that out into the public markets puts it under the glare of publicity, but also potential litigation, and I just wonder if it will continue to be so useful, so maybe we need to look at that. Thank you.
I'm not Ann Simpson. My name's Meredith Williams. I want to know how close I am to the cliff. I truly do. I want to know, on the accounting side, how hard the entity is pushing. Are they on the edge there as well? How hard are they leaning on the accounting standards? I don't get to sit in the boardroom. I certainly don't have time to call the head of the engagement, the audit partner, the top-level audit partner. But I got to know, and again, I don't know the right question to ask. Maybe my right question is, would you, head auditor, put your money in this firm? Would you buy stock in this company? I need some feel. I don't get that now. You know, the pass-fail thing is fine. That allows you in our gate, and we'll then put you through the rest of the analysis to decide whether we want to buy you or sell you. But so the pass-fail has some significant benefit, but I got to know more. I really like the idea of perhaps having some access to an auditor discussion analysis, so long as it includes some kind of a sensitivity analysis that others have referred to. In saying this is a going concern and so forth, what number are you using as your basis? What happens if things go askew in one direction or another? How thick is the ice? So those are my thoughts on these very important matters. Thank you.
Damon?
I have a couple of comments on this discussion. The first is, and I said this before at the SAG, but I'll say it here, there are some very large issues that I think are now fairly clear in relationship to the sort of the reliability or the seriousness with which investors take audited financials in the audit process, and one of them has surfaced in our discussions today, and the other has not. And I just want to—it's important to put them on the record in this conversation. And then I want to shift to at least one type of response that one could imagine to this set of problems that often seems kind of intractable. The two problems that have surfaced, I think, in the last 24 months that are really very serious and unaddressed are, one, the issue that came up in relation to the foreign auditors and in relation to China. And the conversation ended, but I think I want to bring it back up here because it's relevant to this discussion. You know, Lynn asserted that essentially we have an audit process in China and perhaps in other countries that's simply not reliable and not likely to be fixed. Given the degree of economic integration of the United States and U.S. public companies with China's economy, we're essentially, if that's true, and we've had, again, discussions at the Standing Advisory Group about this, if that is true, then that is a very serious problem for the integrity of our auditing process and our public company financial statements, because increasingly Chinese operations, directly and indirectly, are just integrally part of our corporate economy. The second problem that we have is not one we can blame on anybody else, and that is in relationship to our financial institutions. I serve on the oversight panel for TARP. In that context, our staff has tried to determine the extent of impaired assets in our public companies in the financial sector, particularly in the very large systemically significant banks. The question simply can't be answered. The nature of the way in which the audit firms, the issuers, and FASB have interacted over the last year or so made this sort of fundamental question about our economy and about the health of these large firms unanswerable. These are issues, these are post-Sarbanes-Oxley issues that really raise sort of profound systemic doubts about what we're doing here. Now, as long as you know, explicitly or as long as explicitly or implicitly, the American public is guaranteeing the financial solvency of those institutions. It's a little unclear exactly what that means for investors, but I'm not sure that's a comforting assurance. Now, with those two very large caveats, let's turn to the more ordinary course of what we've been just discussing. So we have this problem that we have a binary auditor's opinion, and one switches you're fine, and the other switches you're dead, effectively. Investors and I think and the general public can sometimes find that unsatisfactory as a source of information. And there are two types of options that are often offered, and I think, at least I believe, that neither one of them will achieve much of anything. I think the idea of a multi-grade audit doesn't work because everyone will turn out to be above average, and essentially the binary system will continue under another name. The second idea is that we give the auditors an opportunity to write a long essay about the company. I think we've all seen what those long essays turn into. Not much information in the end gets conveyed because it's dangerous to everybody to do so. The only be more productive is I think we all know what we're trying to get at, which is that in the course of an audit, at some point, a handful of issues, hopefully, get identified as being problematic. And sources of tension between the preparer and the preparer's financial staff and the auditor. And those issues get wrestled around with, and eventually, unless things are going unraveling very fast, eventually those issues get resolved and a clean audit letter is issued. I think what investors really want to know is what are those issues? And as Lynn said, there's a memo that lists them that the audit firm has and that investors don't have. How would we surface those issues without surfacing everything? Because I'm not sure we want to surface everything. And I think there's a simple way to do it. I'm not sure anybody has the sort of the, as we were discussing at lunch, I'm not sure anyone has the guts to do it this way, but there's a simple way to do it, and that is to require that as part of the audit letter, that three or five, or, you know, you pick your number, material items be listed that were the subject that in the auditor's opinion are the most debatable aspects of the financial statement. If that internal memo exists, if you had to list three or five or even one, it's hard to imagine how you avoid doing so given that the internal memo exists and it can be checked against if things were to go badly. That would bring those items out. I think investors would very much like to see what those items are. I haven't thought through, and I'm not certain exactly whether you could do that in a way that would maintain the current dynamics, the current behind-the-scenes dynamics, which in certain ways are helpful. There is a value to the incentive process that the firm has resolving those items. The way firms do currently, right? Obviously, if you meet the auditor's concern, then you don't have a problem. What I'm suggesting is a system in which there would be no way to avoid having to actually tell the public what the dodgy items were and how they were resolved. And I think this is more like that approach would be more likely to actually generate information than either a narrative or a graded final audit opinion. I offer that for people's contemplation.
This is Norman Harrison. I'm actually tempted to just to take my sign down and pass because I think that was well said, Damon. And in fact, it was. I will be brief because you said it much more succinctly. But I was going to make the broader point, and Damon's suggestion fits neatly into it. I think, in many respects, we are all talking about the same thing here, and whether it's a matter of whether we change the format of the report or we have an auditor's discussion and analysis, or at the end of the day, what we're talking about is disclosure, and I'm not sure that the manner in which what we call it or where in the audit papers it comes is as important as what we're getting, and I think Damon has hit it. What we're concerned about is, in addition to things we've already discussed about how, you know, the independence determination was made at the threshold and how the engagement was staffed and planned, most importantly from the investor standpoint, what issues of concern came up along the way, and how did the auditor get comfortable? Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. It's about getting comfortable putting your giving that grade, whatever it is, and signing that report. And I think that is the key disclosure that we're looking for here. And if perhaps that is a good suggestion, I think there would be some benefit from some further review by this group. But to use the conclusion memo, I mean, the management letter, there are documents prepared in the course of an audit that contain or highlight those issues and to distill those into some type of meaningful disclosure at the conclusion of the process that auditors, the investing public would have access to, I think would be a breakthrough. And so that's my final word. Thank you.
Tony? Thank you. This is Tony Sondi. There are about three or four points that I wanted to just go back to. One of the issues that was raised was how, you know, we'd like to know how far we are from the cliff. Unfortunately, you're often told that you're quite a distance from the cliff, and then there's a review at the national office level, and you discover that your audit partner was actually wrong, but you don't have any recourse anymore. You've got to fix that. The seemingly arbitrary nature of those types of decisions is something that investors would benefit understanding better. The other issue, though, is a little bit different, and I'm concerned that whether it's pass or fail or different type of grade, the problem is that it's still scorekeeping. That's what they're telling us. They're not giving us better information. It's unclear to me, to some extent, whether we're really wondering whether auditors ought to tell us a little bit more after analyzing the company. One of the things that I'll just very briefly tell you about, one of the ratios or rate analytical methods that I use a great deal is to look at what I call the cash cycle of a firm. Look at the number of days it has inventories in hand, add that to the number of days it takes to collect its receivables, and subtract from that the number of days it takes to pay its suppliers. I call that the cash cycle. It has been shown for the last several years to be a very, very good indicator of companies that are in trouble. Now, just imagine the amount of time it takes. And if it takes you you can find out about 2 to 3 years in advance, that means there was something seriously wrong with those numbers in the financial statements. When the day's sales outstanding continues to climb, is it not normal to expect that the analysis of uncollectibles should have been done a little bit differently? Well, that's one of the estimates that I'm assuming auditors are looking at. Another comment that was made was that there are some issues with respect to the estimation errors in fair value. But what about the estimation errors in accruals? We've learned lately that there are tremendous estimation errors in the amount of liquidity that people report to. If you don't look at the option rate preferreds and the money markets with some care, you can certainly tell people, yeah, they've got this much in option rate preferreds, but we're not saying anything about whether you're going to collect them. When you look at it from that perspective, or you take the issue of whether the existence of off-balance sheet financing activities, the existence of special purpose entities or variable interest entities, is really an issue between the accounting standards, standard setters, and that, you know, between the PCAOB, my question is, the existence of such vehicles such as special purpose entities and the variable interest entities, other off-balance sheet activities, they do suggest a certain amount of risk. The fact that we're not going to account for them doesn't eliminate the risk. So from that perspective, I think we need to look at this a little bit differently. Yes, there are errors in estimation. I served on the expert advisory panel on measurement of the fair value of illiquid securities. We did tell and we did come up with ways in which you would do a sensitivity analysis, and some of that now is part of the standards. The question is, you know, what should I expect the auditor to be able to tell me about these things other than saying that somebody actually showed them
a spreadsheet which had some of this analysis. Is the conduct, is completion of an analysis a sufficient audit process?
Bonnie Hill, I'd like to go back to something that Ann said that I think really goes to the heart of the matter of the disclosures or transparency, however we want to define it. And that has to do with public and non-public information. How much information, is the company willing to share, or the auditor, because of the exposure that they have, in the legal sense as well. And what comes to my mind is discussions we have in the boardroom or in the audit committee on materiality and what a particular what our auditors thought and what our internal auditors and our finance people thought, and if there's a difference there, how they got to the place that they did. And we have those discussions. There are a lot of things that you'll discuss as it relates to the auditor's report, even before it's actually published, that are not things that you're necessarily going to shed the light on for the general public, because on a daily basis or a monthly basis or whatever the case may be, you'd have your stock price jerked around in some incredible fashion because people just don't know how it's going to come out when you're working through issues. I think when I talk about the transparency, I think the important thing is, what is the process that you use? How do you resolve discrepancies? And if there are serious issues, then I think, of course, those have to be disclosed. But, from my experience, what happens is you go to a certain point and the lawyers will say, that's non-public and you can't disclose that. So, as we move forward, and I think what we all agree on is very important, which is making certain that the investor knows what kind of risk they're taking. Those risks are being evaluated on almost a daily basis inside the company and inside the boardroom and with the auditors. And much of it, you're just not going to get. You can get a longer report, and what it's going to say is, we've used this type of process to get to this place, and our conclusion is thus. And I just don't think you're going to get the detailed, description of everything that takes place.
Well, Bonnie, Norman, and Kelvin, thank you very much for leading that discussion, that panel. Why don't we take a 15-minute break until 4:15, and then we'll be back and conclude by 5 o'clock. Okay, why don't we get started with our next panel, which is Audit Expertise and Responsibilities. And Charlie, why don't you go ahead and introduce the panel?
Okay, thank you, Steve. I think it's appropriate that our last session with a designated subject matter is kind of wide-ranging. Auditor Expertise and Responsibilities. Certainly we've heard some comments that go from auditor's level of knowledge of complicated financial instruments, certainly knowledge of accounting standards and accounting standards, especially in an environment in which there is a great promise of some fairly drastic changes in the accounting standards, disclosures, issues related to whether to include references to the internal audit function in the auditing standards, as well as adding a forensic audit component to the standard audit process. To lead us off, Robert Tirola will start, and then Tony Santi, and then last but not least, Judge Sporkin. Gentlemen, it's yours.
Thank you, Charlie. Bob Tirola speaking. I want to take the group down memory lane. Those of you with gray hair, and there's a few of us in the room. 30 years ago, companies produced financial statements and auditors provided an opinion on those financial statements, and that was basically the financial reporting that investors received. Move forward a little bit. Management's discussion and analysis was required, I'm going to guess, in the late 70s, and the auditors reported on the financial statements.
And then more disclosures were requested around around risks and exposures, and auditors reported on the financial statements. And then more disclosures around compensation and enterprise risk management, and auditors reported on the financial statements. The point I'm trying to make here is that companies are producing comprehensive reports about their business, about how they're managing their business, about how they're compensating executives, their philosophies around risk mitigation. But the auditors are looking at the financial statements. From my perspective, anyway, that's a far too limited role for auditors in helping investors. That they touch every page of those reports, whether it's a 10K, a 10Q, or a proxy, yet their responsibility is to the narrow part of it called financial statements. I've been an auditor, and I've worked with auditors as a CFO and as an audit committee member, and they crawl all over the company. They know whether or not the disclosures about the business are fair and reasonable. They assess whether or not the measurements for executive compensation are correct and accurate. Yet we don't call upon them to make any sort of comment about the larger aspect of the company's financial report. We limit their role to the financial statements. I believe the PCAOB has the ability to expand the role of the auditor to more than just the financial statements. I think investors would be well served if there was a type of validation that was applied to the entire company report by the auditor, not just the financial statements themselves, not even, again, going to the discussion of the financial statements. So our panel is to talk about auditors' responsibilities and the expertise to carry out those responsibilities. If the role of the auditor was to expand beyond the financial statements, it's going to take a different expertise, and I'm going to let Tony pick up on that. But as an investor, when I think about either myself personally or my role in investment companies, what the market really wants is a validation of the value factors in the marketplace. Wants a validation of whether or not market risk is fairly assessed. So what role could the auditor play in helping the market get comfortable with the elements of valuation, whether it's integrity of management, whether it's ability to continue to grow, whether it's the prospect of a new product, whatever factors may be in the marketplace that are generally discussed in company reports, what role should the auditor play in helping validate the broad-based information in the marketplace, not just the financial statements? And then, Tony, what expertise would they need?
Thank you, Bob. This is Tony Sonley. I'm going to talk about three specific areas. Disclosures, because that's what, as an analyst, that's what I always focus on. Securitizations, off-balance sheet activities, and derivatives. Now, with respect to disclosures, those of you and all of us here, of course, have read footnotes or financial statements, and we know that at the bottom of the page, every one of them, every page, it says these footnotes are an integral part of the financial statements. But for the 10 years that I've been on the standard-setting bodies, one of the first things I remember telling the EITF the day I joined them was that it seems as if there are two laws that we operate by. One is that we don't talk about accounting after 4 p.m. on Fridays. And there's a corollary to that, that we never discuss disclosures before 4:30 p.m. on Fridays. And, so if you go back and take a look at the EITFs, you'll discover it. You go back 6 years, you will find that so many of them don't have disclosure requirements. And I don't understand that. They're supposed to be accounting standards. Think about one of the biggest changes that we've had in recent years, the accounting standard on stock options. when 123R became required, a lot of companies discovered that they didn't have enough information to calculate certain deferred taxes. However, they were supposed to have been doing that for 10 years at that point. And they all had audits for 10 years at that point, and yet they didn't know anything about their deferred or sufficient information about their deferred tax assets. Now, that's just, you know, in a sense, one example. We have more than 100 accounting standards on revenue recognition. There are a few components of financial reporting that are as poorly served by disclosures as revenue recognition. EITF 0021, which talks about multiple element arrangements. We used to have two requirements which are fundamentally just descriptive. Every one of the accounting firms that's writing about the replacement, the amendment of 0021, EITF 081, starts off by saying there's going to be a tremendous expansion in your disclosure requirements, which the way I see it, now you're actually going to have to talk about what you were doing. So in that sense, disclosures, I think, have been unfortunately neglected. And I don't understand why auditors don't audit the disclosures to the extent that I believe they should. Securitizations, the other off-balance sheet activities. As I said, those accounting transactions, there may be to some extent problems with our accounting standards, special purpose entities, the QSPEs, for example, which we've finally gotten rid of. But the point is that there is a substantive amount of risk that remains on the books. You don't find a lot of companies actually selling those kinds of assets. However, we created an accounting standard that permits the recognition of a sale transaction. Lawyers give true sale opinions, and they give the consolidation opinions. But you could ask one lawyer or two lawyers or three lawyers, and you'll get a ton of different explanations of what a true sale means. They're not fundamentally either economic or accounting concepts, and yet they've informed our financial statements extremely poorly, I would say, over the years. Consider the disclosures and derivatives. Do you really think that it's rational to expect a company that engages in several billion dollars of trading in derivatives to tell you that an X percent increase on either side in either the interest rate or the foreign exchange risk is not going to cause us any losses? How many people do you know who are perfect with respect to derivatives? And yet if I read disclosure, they were not going to have any losses as a result of those derivatives. And yet we have these disclosures that are sent to us over and over again with clean opinions. I'll give you just as the last point. This is sort of eerily reminiscent to me, at least, of Repo 105 transactions, which most of you are probably aware of. A few years ago, 1999 to be exact, a company made the following disclosure. And I'm just going to tell you two sentences in it. Year end was September 30. On the 10th of September, the company created a finance subsidiary and sold its $600 million of receivables. And the finance subsidiary is 100% owned. And the company, in order to make that sale, set aside $750 million in collateral. Now, what do you think? Do you think a sale occurs for $600 million if you have to put up $750 as collateral? But it gets better. The next line. In October, we repurchased all the receivables and shut down the subsidiary. And this was treated as a sale. It's not all that different from Repo 105. But, you know, I don't want to hold them hold them out as the only company that does that. There are a lot of financial institutions that have been engaging in that game. And there are lots of companies that we don't think of as financial institutions that have also played that game. So the point, I think, is, from my perspective, we need a better understanding of disclosures on the part of the auditors. We need them to review them. When you open up the Dow 30, for example, and look for the derivative disclosures, and for the Dow 30 you find that the derivative disclosures in those 30 companies read identically, there's got to be something wrong. These are boilerplate disclosures. How can Exxon possibly be telling you the same thing as GE? And how can an airline have the same wording for a disclosure requirement as a metals company? So in that sense, we need a better understanding of what these financial statements are supposedly telling investors.
Terrific stuff, but let me go back a little bit to basics here. While I might hold the accountants, give them a little tough love, it shouldn't denigrate my view of the accounting profession. And I think that was shown when we created the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the late 70s. And I must tell you, it was based upon the great esteem we had for the accounting profession, because it was thought when the books and records provisions would be put in, that was done so the accountants would find all the schmutz and be able to disclose it. But let us now talk about, we sort of have to differentiate some of the things we're talking about today, separate the apples from the oranges. The first thing that we expect the accounting profession to do is mine the data. They have to find the data. The second thing is, when they find the data, what are they going to do with it? And so there are two big issues that come along that challenge the accounting profession. In other words, if they mine the data and they don't find what's going on, then obviously they're not going to be able to issue the kind of report that's necessary. And talking about mining the data, something has cropped up over the years in which the accounting profession says, well, we're going to mine it, but we're only going to be looking for material kinds of things, little stuff we're not going to look at. And so, therefore, the people on the other side that's trying to defeat the system, and remember there's a tension that's taking place here, people trying to defeat the system, at the same time you have the profession that's and the good guys that are trying to make sure that it's working. And so we have that so the people who are trying to defeat the system have learned exactly the way the accounting profession works. And so we developed the so-called financial audit. And the financial audit, as I told you before, is looking for big things, looking for materiality. Now comes fraud. And the accounting profession says, well, we don't, used to say, it's changed a little bit, we're not looking for fraud. And to bolster that, the people that are trying to defeat the system, they understand that, and so they go under the radar screen. And they go out and deal with the system so that they can beat it. For example, if you're trying to bribe somebody and you don't want the accountants to find it, you do it by doing the kinds of things in the accounts that they don't look at. Petty cash account. We don't want to get into petty cash. It's too small. And yet, the people defeating the system use it to get the money to pay the bribes. And they do it all the time. So, the first thing you got to do is devise this system so that the accounting profession is now going to be looking at that aspect of it. And what is the thing that I had to come up with this concept in connection with a client. And so what we did with the client, which is an accounting firm, what we did with the client, we said, okay, wouldn't it be nice to combine forensic accounting with a financial audit? Bring the two together. So the forensics will look for the under the radar screen, and the financial audit will go into their dance with respect to the materiality. This works. We've had one season where we did it. It's good. And now we're going back to the second season. And I can say to you, it will work. And I think hopefully it will become packaged and become maybe a part of the whole system. I don't see any reason why that kind of concept can't work. Second thing that I find when I look at the accounting profession
Now, remember, I have I was trained as a CPA, so I have a little accounting background. Second thing I found, which I think is quite interesting, is the fact that when the SEC looks at a transaction, it's different than when the accounting profession looks at a transaction. Why, I don't know, but it's like night and day sometimes. And so the concept there that I'm trying to develop is the concept of a compliance component in an accounting firm that will look at the end of an audit, will go through the audit and look at the items based upon now, we have a history now, of so many things involved in the in trying to defeat the system that they will know fully what they are, whether it's the 105s or the each time we get another one of these these things such as the 105s or the special purpose entities, to build information concerning them, have this person who's highly trained in this area to look at the audit, step back and say, wait a second, what is it that does this audit show any of these items? And if so, to be able to see how they were dealt with. And so that's something that I think is important. Now, the other area, remember I talked about mining, getting the information, bubbling it up, getting it up to the top. The second area now is how does the accountant handle this? Accountant now knows, let's assume my system works, he now knows what the problems are, and now we get back to, I guess it was Turner's point, what I used to call the exception list that the accountants have at the end of the audit, and to take up and sort of getting in a negotiation with the company. And here we have the same problem we were talking about today. Does the accountant have the fortitude to be able to stand up to the company and tell them that with respect to these items, they've got to be dealt with right? I remember I had one case where an old fellow named Bluedorn, I don't know if that name means anything to anybody anymore, but he had an asset on Gulf and Western. It was $28 million. In those days, millions meant something. In a company that was kaput. And so he came up with a scheme that the company invested in sugar plantations. So he went around and he was buying sugar plantations, and what he would do is he would give them cash and some of the kaput company and say, okay, I'll pay you $5 million plus I'll give you $2 million of this kaput company. And so he was able through this way, buying a number of this, to take off completely the bad asset. And it then went into the sugar plantations where nobody would ever know about it. In any event, as property went up in value, it would mask what they were doing. And I remember calling in the head of the audit firm because we were ready to take action. And the fellow was quite candid. He said to me, Stan, he said, let me tell you something. At the end of the audit, we had 5 items. We sat down with management, and you know what? We won on 4 of them, 80%. He says, that's not a bad percentage, and therefore we had to give him this one. And, you know, you know, I had to tell him that 80% might be good in certain things, but it isn't good in accounting. And so, therefore, how do you get the profession and the accounting firm to stand up and say, look, no, we're not going to stand for it. We're going to go for the 100%. We saw today where we're talking about this business of the foreign auditor. And, you know, it's nothing. It's common for people to be worrying about other people's concerns. And I've learned through my many, many years that once you compromise your principles and say, well, it might not be that bad. It's a prescription for disaster. It happened with the SEC in the Madoff case. It happens all the time. And so how do you inspire or get the accounting profession, and this is to me, I think, is a core issue, that once they have to make a decision that's tough on their client, for them to say, yeah, that they're going to go through with it. That, I think, is really the core issue. The mining can be taken care of, as I told you about the combination, but the real problem is once they know about it. This is not something that they don't know about, but once they know about it, to be able to carry through and tell the client that, no, they cannot do what they want to do. And I don't know how you get, other than by getting people like the PCAOB, when they find it, to be able to say, folks, you're going to get, it's going to cost you. And I think that's where we got to do. So that's my sermon for the day. Charlie, what do you think?
You're my hero, Stanley.
Kelvin, I think that you mentioned also in your priorities a modified forensic, either the concept of a forensic or a modified forensic. And then I think you also indicated that that was in a report, the global capital markets and the global economy, a vision for the CEOs of the international audit networks, which was issued in November of 2006 for consideration. You want to spend a minute or two and review some of your thoughts on that as well?
Sure. I've mentioned some type of a modified forensic audit requirement where in areas where there's been known fraud, perhaps the PCAOB and the other auditing agencies should impose some type of forensic audit requirement where it requires to go beyond the routine financial statement audit and require more in-depth analysis of the transactions. One of the things I suggested, and it's based upon my background as a compliance auditor, is when I do audits and I go and do the audits and I notice that some of the examiners from other states, they may want to focus on looking at a set 10% of the transactions, 10% of the customer files, and they think they can then take that and project it onto the 100% of what the transactions would be. But I think that low threshold is extremely too low, and I think we should require the audit firms to look at more than, say, 5 or 10% of the transactions and then project it onto the overall population. If you require the audit firm to look at more, higher percentage of the population, you may have a better chance of detecting any irregularities.
Thank you, Steve. I got to run for an airport here before long, but I did want to make a couple comments. I think Tony is absolutely correct in that we spend all week long auditing the numbers, but only look at disclosures at 4:30 in the afternoon. That has certainly typically been my experience, and I think you raise this a very good point. The professional standards do require the auditors to go get evidence, substantial evidence for the footnotes, but they tend to do it at the last moment, ask a client to give them some schedule that'll tie out to the footnote, and boom, and they're done. I actually, probably some more guidance would be helpful, but more than anything would be some good strict enforcement. If out of your inspections and out of your enforcement program, you took a hard look at these and actually took enforcement actions against some firms that had failed to gather the evidence they needed for the footnotes, I think that would be excellent. Now, I know you're hamstrung now because of the private nature of your enforcement actions, and unfortunately, Stanley had, and those of us at the SEC had, a much more public enforcement regime. We made 102Es a public process during Dan's stint as general counsel, much to his credit. And I honestly think you absolutely need to go get legislation and get a change here to be able to make your enforcement actions public. Keeping them private has proven just to engender the accounting firms to fight you all the way through. So I think, one, that grammatically needs to be changed, and as an investor, I'd like to see that so we get some timely enforcement. But I think if you took enforcement actions against a couple firms on disclosures, and now your inspection process came out with, I think it's a 40-20 report that said, here in general is some shortcomings that we've seen from the inspections, I think the combination of those things would be very helpful. As far as expanding the auditor's role, I have been a fan of having the auditor go ahead and give a report on MD&As. Quite some time ago, there was a standard that the profession floated. Actually, I think about the same time Dan was general counsel as well. And nothing has happened with that. I think having an auditor report, providing some assurance around what's in that MD&A report and the completeness of that report to us about the trends and what's going on with operations would be of tremendous help. On the forensic angle, I do sit and chair the audit committee of a public entity where we actually do engage the auditor and pay him extra to have a forensic accountant come in each year and do work for us. Now, we design that each year around the particulars, and I sit down with that person and say, here's what I want you to do for us. But we do have a forensic piece of it, and I think it's very good in that it keeps people on their toes, and it's been good in framing the mindset of the auditors, the regular auditors, if you will. So I think, as the O'Malley panel recommended, building some type of that forensic expertise and notion into the regular audit would be very beneficial. I've done that, and I found it to be very helpful and very good. And, in fact, I found that it has, in some instances, done a very good job then of informing the audit staff of some things that they hadn't focused on and subsequently did. So I'd be a big supporter of doing that.
Joe, before we go to you, I don't know, Meredith, I know you got to take off for a plane shortly as well. Do you have any, I mean, we can go to Joe, but if you have any comments that you'd like to make before you clear out of here, certainly
thank
want to
you,
give
Mr.
you the
Chairman. Opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for having to leave early. I have an engagement with several of those 463,000 members tomorrow morning in Western Colorado. However, I'm a strong supporter of the forensic approach. I think it's a different mindset. I think it does a wonderful job of keeping the entity on its toes. Just knowing that a different look will be taken on a regular basis. Going back to my rotation pitch, I would suggest that not be the same forensic accounting firm each year, and I see them probably, you know, working, whether they work separate and then report directly to the company, the audit committee, or if they're an adjunct to the regular audit effort. Just to have that presence, I think, is the most important thing. Thank you.
Well, since we've heard it before, I'd like to get the response from the judge, Kelvin, and you in terms of the cost. And how we deal with that. Judge, we've raised it with you, and I'd like to get all three of you to respond to that.
This has come up in connection with Foreign Corrupt Practices Act matters. And my discussion with my clients, other than the accounting firm, is since I think they all have been faced with FCPA issues. They think it's terrific. They think it's much cheaper than having to go through a Siemens, $1 billion investigation. And so the cost hasn't really been an issue there. Remember, you're going to have to do a lot of risk assessment as to how you want to do it and what you're going to be looking for. You're not going to go in and do a general forensic on so it shouldn't be that much, and I have not yet seen a pushback on the cost. It probably will be there, but we'll have to wait and see.
Meredith?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Meredith Williams. I totally agree with Judge Borkin. I believe that on a risk-reward basis, you can't afford to go in the other direction. Again, I think it would require a regular assessment of where you want to focus those resources in any given time frame, and I think that would change over time as the risks change. Small price to pay.
Well, I guess you're out of here, too. Why don't we go around this way?
Just real quickly, Steve, because I have done this, and we've made it part of our audit process. The cost was fairly negligible in comparison to the overall audit fee. It was not that significant to have it done. The benefits in terms of what they learned and how that informed the audit and improved the audit process in and of itself, including some risk and some things we needed to change, was very helpful to the audit team as well as to the audit committee and the board, so that was very helpful. And when you look at the benefit, though, you also have to measure what happens in the market when you find these things. And if we could have avoided even a small fraction of these losses and headed off some of this stuff, the benefit would have been tremendous. And the one thing that I've seen when you did these forensic audits, we've all talked about how is it that the auditors never saw, or right, management never saw, or the board never set up and said anything about these subprime loans and the things that other people were engaging, the repo 105 transactions. The one thing I found is that forensic auditor is the one person that walks in the room and says, time out. What are people thinking? That's what that, my experience has been, that's what that forensic person does. And the benefit of having had, if we'd had some people in these rooms at a Countrywide, you know, at a Citigroup, at an AIG, standing in there and saying, time out, what are you guys thinking about? The benefit would have been immense to us, and the cost would have been a drop in the bucket. And, you know, like I said, we do it.
Joe, and then we'll just go right the way around.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go, Steve. And I think what I heard, and I thought it was very good, from Bob was talking about, if I heard him right, additional auditor involvement with the MD&A, maybe the CD&A, FX hotline, ERM system. I agree they're all important, and I think auditor attestation on those would be useful. And then I heard the judge talk about the forensic audit, and I think that would be extremely useful. But as I was sitting here, the issue that came to my mind is exactly the issue that you raised, and that is, to the extent the auditor is involved in these spaces, would the benefits exceed the costs? And so I want to pose a question to Gus and to Ann, and now, you know, they're Gus is with obviously a very large mutual fund complex. Ann is a very large public pension fund. To a lesser extent, a little bit different, Pete and Norman, representing, in my mind, a hedge fund and a private equity group. And because if you propose this, here's what's going to happen. Management is going to say, no, we don't want to pay the extra fees. But it's not their money. It's really, in Gus's case, my money, right, in my 403B and 401K, but he has to make the decision. I can't make the decision. There's too many of me's. So how much value does this have for investors, and what is, you know, what are you guys willing to pay for it? Because that's really the decision, not what management says. That's really kind of irrelevant.
Pete knocked away. Actually, I think this dialogue has been great. I'd expand it probably well beyond just the forensic end, although I've got a very healthy respect for what forensic accounting can do. But, you know, look at what we do when we buy a company. And, yeah, you know, our portfolio, we've got about 500 entities across 67 different funds. And we rely on our investment professionals basically to go in and identify what the risks are and what we want to kind of peel back layers of the onion on every single company we look at. Now, we don't get forever to do that. Typically, we get a matter of weeks if we're in an auction or a bidding process. But the kind of things that we bring in addition to the forensic side, if we have any concerns, are going to be valuation experts, actuarial experts, engineering, you know, could be whether it's oil reserves or it's long-term construction contracts or complex manufacturing contracts. getting that kind of expertise involved from our standpoint to diligence a company we're looking at buying is almost the same kind of thing that auditors need to be doing to say, or the, you know, the financial statements that all of us are relying on to make investment decisions reliable. The challenge is, and I think most of the accounting firms have maintained at one point or another resources in all of those areas. I think what where most of them are today, forensic accounting and valuation is almost standard table stakes. That you've got to have those experts and probably actuarial. But the issue is, you know, getting the clients to pay for it. That's, you know, again, one of our big challenges. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about that, but, you know, at the end of the day, the clients pay for the audits, and how do we make sure that that becomes part of the, if it's part of the audit standard where every accounting firm has to do it, so there's no optionality if I want to go look at, well, geez, firm X is going to foist all these experts on me, but firm Y is going to say I don't need to use them, or they're not going to need to use them in the audit. I think, we, again, something that this group could possibly help with, or PCOB could help with, is taking that optionality out of the audit. Second is, how do you maintain the capability? And that's more of a business issue, because you really need world-class people facing off. You know, you don't want to have, you know, a young capital markets guy on one of the guy or gal at one of the accounting firms going up against Fab, whatever his name is, at Goldman Sachs, you know, without the same level of both talent, energy, experience, et cetera, and how can they maintain that inside the Big Four if they're just audit support? So, you know, allowing them to actually be in the business commercially helps them to maintain the expertise. And then last but not least, we talked a lot about disclosures for companies and financial statements, but maybe there should be a little bit of disclosure around the experts that were used in an audit, so that we as investors or users of the financial statement, if we're looking at an insurance company and there's no actuaries involved, or an oil company and there's no engineers involved that understand oil reserves, you might scratch your head a little bit. So just some thoughts.
Gus?
Thank you. This is Gus Sauter. Joe asked the question, you know, what do we think as investors of other people's money about the costs of requiring forensic accounting? And number one, I'm going to say I'm probably a little bit of odds with the rest of the people around the table, perhaps because, quite honestly, I don't know what the cost of forensic accounting would be. Lynn said that it's really not much, and I think Judge Sporkin pointed out that you wouldn't just blindly do it across the board, that you would measure risks and then apply it accordingly. Costs do matter at the end of the day, and it's not just the level of the costs, but it's the total value over time of those costs as well. So if we're talking about, you know, really what could be hundreds of millions of dollars of additional costs of accounting, that could be billions of dollars worth of value when you assign a PE ratio to it. Nevertheless, it's pointed out that if you catch one bad actor, that could pay for that. So on the one hand, I ask the question, does it need to be an independent forensic accounting, or should this be something that we require inside of a normal audit? That audit firms perhaps should have this capability themselves. It's not forensic accountants aren't super accountants. You know, why wouldn't this be something that the accounting firm could do? So I come at this from two different directions, saying there certainly can be some benefit to it, particularly when you catch the bad actor. But I am concerned about costs, and I do raise the question about what the form should be. Is it truly an independent forensic accountant? Could it be the same? Should it be required of auditors in general?
Sure.
Some of the firms, some of the Big Four, have, and they probably all do, but I know specifically on at least some of them, they actually have very complex algorithms as they plan the engagement. And the algorithms measure financial characteristics, governance characteristics, a whole bunch of other things that you could probably think through. And they've essentially back-tested these algorithms against restatements, and then they assign loadings out of a regression on the factors, and they come up with a risk score. Okay, so it's essentially a risk model. And if the risk score is above a certain cut, this particular firm requires involvement by forensic auditors. But that's a voluntary decision. Would it make sense from an investor perspective, at least, you know, from your point of view, maybe not to go to a blanket forensic requirement, but to say if risk is assessed at high, and you got to be careful with language, but if risk is assessed as high, then that's a requirement on the audit. And then the cost is more targeted to where the risk is higher.
Let me mention what my model is, in which we're testing. And my model is every firm has a forensic component. The problem is, when I went in there, is I found out that forensic component was doing work with third-party companies, not with their own clients. So the answer is yes, you use your own. The accounting firm, under my model, would use its own forensics, so that there's a synergy and everything else there. You know, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that if you're doing business in China or in some other foreign country where you have a high risk of a bribery, I mean, that's right away tells you that you gotta do something. Any company that's doing business in those countries, that's doing so like a horse with blinders and not worrying about this, you know, it's a no-brainer. I mean, how can they just walk in and say, well, we're not going to consider any of this? And so to me, it became obvious, this kind of thing, as to how you have to put these things two together. I mean, it's no genius here. You put them together because you see that all you do is talk to an accountant. He's talking to you about the materiality. He doesn't want to look at that thing. It's not material. You talk to your forensic, and he's interested in the low-hanging fruit. He's interested in looking at that. So that's it. No, but you should use the same accounting firm to cut down on costs. There's no reason why it has to be an independent. I think it would be too disruptive, and there would be too many. Already there's some disagreements we're finding in connection with my analysis of the pilot program that we're using. There is some contention there, but that can be worked out.
It's Norman Harrison. First on the resource question, I think the judge is absolutely right, and Joe, you know, in my experience, the Big Four firms certainly have a talented pool of auditors and accountants with forensic backgrounds. I think most of them happen to reside in the advisory practice, and that's, you know, they're, as the judge said, providing those services, but to perhaps non-audit clients. But I think the resources are certainly there. It'll be a question of allocation and how to build that into the model. With regard to your question, Joe, about, you know, how much, what's the value, or how much would investors be willing to pay? I'm going to answer it like a lawyer, not like an investor. My answer is the lawyer's typical answer, and that is it depends. It depends on what we're getting, what incremental comfort or assurance we're getting from the additional effort, I think. And Tony, in his opening comments, made reference to the expansion of scope of areas or resources in an audit process in an effort to achieve some validation of things. And I think, you know, when you start down the path toward validation or verification, I've often wondered if we were going to go back to square one and design the auditing process and profession all over again, would we find, or have we gotten to a point where there is, in essence, a sort of fundamental mismatch between what auditors are selling and what issuers want to buy? Is it something more like assurance? And if so, then what does that tell you about the business model and about pricing and about risk and about liability and all of these issues? I mean, there are a lot of very big macro issues here, I think, that your subject touches upon in terms of what it is that we hope and expect, and I think sometimes perhaps wrongly assume that the audit process is delivering to us. But if we could really get it, you know, it would be something presumably that you would be willing to pay for.
Brandon Becker, just a couple of brief observations. Just a reminder that we had a conversation about a fraud center or some lessons learned assessment earlier today, and it would seem to me that if you had a more robust one, it could help supplement and assist the risk assessment process of what you did with your forensic audits, and you could help bring a better identification of where you wanted to allocate those resources. With respect to the cost issue, I concur with it depends. If it's just another checklist of items that are an added expense across the board. I don't think it provides much value added. If it's the kind of sensitive assessment of risk on a targeted basis, and you can assure me that Judge Sporkin is doing that on each menu item, then I think it's going to provide value added. But that would be the trade-off, is whether it became a more mechanical process rather than a well-textured assessment of individual risks. And then third, I think it was Peter who mentioned earlier, one of the things that I'm most concerned about, apart from forensics, is whether we maintain the expertise and talent within the audit function. So for me, independence and other issues and what migrates into advisory are interesting questions, and we use various prophylactics and rules to do that. But what I worry about structurally is whether we siphon off all the key talent into those functions, and how do we maintain the talent in the audit function, in the valuation process? Because while I don't in any way want to denigrate the importance of the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act and maintaining the integrity of our payment structure, valuation issues, getting a good assessment of the quality of earnings, is critically important going forward in trying to assess the financial reports of companies. And even more so, I would say, in some instances, without trying to sound sacrilegious, than running to ground their particular payments in a jurisdiction, which we should do, but knowing how they're assessing those risks and having the right talent doing that strikes me as critical to this exercise.
In the information that we circulated, we indicated that we wanted everybody to have the opportunity to express their top priority before we left. We're closing in on 5 o'clock. We've got 20 minutes more. I do want to finish on time. There are three areas that were brought up that I don't think have been covered, and then we'll just close it up with anybody's closing remarks. Brandon Becker and Bob, you mentioned executive compensation in the context of audits. Investor education, the expectations gap. Kelvin, you mentioned that, and Bonnie Hill, you mentioned it, and Meredith is gone, so we'll save some time there. And on inspections, Barbara has gone too, but Bonnie Hill, you mentioned that, and Mike also is gone. So I think we're going to be in pretty good shape getting out of here at the allotted time, and we would have in any event. But on executive compensation, Bob or Brandon, you both mentioned that, and if you want to make some comments on it, we'd appreciate it.
Well, briefly, the point that we tried to make in our written statement, and I'll turn quickly over to Bob, was we're going through a lot of gymnastics to try and rope in executive compensation, and in particular with clawbacks, multi-year payouts, payouts in stock. Those may or may not be relevant to the underlying issues of company management, and we certainly have encouraged say on pay and other investor guidance. But they all strike me at one level as highlighting the fact that we don't trust the earnings that we are reporting because we haven't been able to build in an effective assessment of tail risk when we make a judgment about complicated financial instruments in many regards. And that to the extent that we can improve some of our quality of earnings assessments so that we have greater confidence that we're not going to get these surprises because we haven't valued the instruments correctly in the first place, I think it would help assess and remediate some of the issues that we've identified in terms of trying to deal with the fact that right now we think it's such a soft number, we don't know whether 2 years, 4 years, 6 years from now, the instrument, as it goes through its earning life cycle, is just going to explode on us.
Steve, from my perspective, just taking compensation discussion analysis, there's three major components. There's the measurement of the compensation, which frankly has some complicated formulas involved in it, whether it's the current value of a pension right or the value of a secure or of equity type compensation. Secondly, there's the philosophy discussion, and I guess thirdly, it's how it affects the business of the issuer, whether or not it's really driving the behaviors that the board thinks it should be driving. But that's to me that's just one aspect of a company's disclosure of their story that could be subject to audit that currently isn't.
I try to put myself in the shoes of the board, and looking for the auditor to help validate what the board does on behalf of the shareholder, so that the shareholder gets the benefit of a independent look. The board gets the benefit of an auditor's independent look, and it's across the board. It's across the entire story of the enterprise, not just the balance sheet.
But what is the auditor looking for in terms of executive compensation?
Well, actually, in the where I sit on the audit committee of a public company, we ask the internal auditor to check all the calcs, for one thing. We ask the comp committee to make sure that the philosophy is well articulated, and then the audit committee itself takes on the task of assessing whether or not it's being deployed in a way that promotes what the philosophy is intended to promote: right behaviors, strategic objectives, and it does so effectively. So it's a combination of risk assessment, pure calculating, pure rechecking calcs, and then making sure that it's doing what it ought to do.
Tony and Gus.
This is Tony Sunday. Steve, I was going to say that in response to your question to Bob, one of the things that I have found in my analysis of compensation is that when the compensation exceeds for a particular company, top management exceeds their peers and so on, I find that it's worth taking a look at their financial reporting choices. And I find problems and issues in that. One of my classic examples is one of the biggest companies in this country. They were reporting the gain on sale of patents as a reduction of their SG&A. And it was partly because their CEO's compensation was tied to a reduction in SG&A expenses. So these are the kinds of things you can find, these core relationships, when you look for, and I think that's one of the things that I would ask, when an auditor, it's good for them to check the calculations, but I can actually check most calculations on my own without any help from anybody.
Gus and then Bonnie.
Thank you, Steve. This is Gus Slaughter. We deal directly with the companies that we own, and we talk with them on a constant basis. We send them a letter and tell them exactly what we expect them to do with regard to executive compensation. We want to know what incentives they've aligned and whether or not those incentives are aligned with best value for us. We let them know that if we don't like their compensation incentives, we'll vote against all of the members of the comp committee. We want to know the magnitude of the compensation. Certainly, you talk about a CEO that supposedly added $500 million worth of value to a company and therefore is deserving of $100 million. Quite frankly, we find it a little difficult that somebody else could not have added at least $450 million, so maybe $50 million would have been just fine. There is a maximum level where we think compensation just gets to be too high. Nevertheless, we're not supporters of say on pay, because quite honestly, we think a lot of it's one of those questions that it's almost like asking have you stopped beating your spouse, and you almost can't answer it without. With some degree of objectivity, that most people are going to say, no, I don't like compensation. Well, it's supposedly non-binding, at least at this point in time. I don't know if it is at some point in time, but I think a lot of people just aren't able to say whether or not pay levels are appropriate and yet have the ability to vote on it. So I must say that we're not in favor of say on pay. Steve, you asked what is the auditor's responsibility for this. Is this just information that's required in the financial statements? I think one thing the auditor could divulge is the incentive. So are the incentives really truly aligned
with the investor. And a comment on that from the auditor, I think, would be helpful to individual investors.
Bonnie?
Bonnie Hill. There are a couple of things as it relates to compensation. One is there's a tendency to look at just the upper level of compensation when you're looking at risk. And there are levels of compensation throughout the organization, places and positions where there could be a real risk of fraud. And we would look for the auditors to help identify those and, as a matter of fact, put those down as questions for them when they go through the organization. Do you see any areas in which a particular employee or group of employees have the ability to put the company at risk? And they may not be the highest paid. So that becomes important. In terms of, I'm with Gus on the say on pay part, one, because the compensation committee spent countless hours sorting through compensation, and it is not very easy, as you know, when you look at the proxies and you try to decipher all of the various charts. I am in favor of shareholders having a conversation with the compensation committee or with the company prior to having to make that kind of vote. And so, you know, if they've been following it and the year before they saw something they didn't like, I would encourage that they would have that discussion with the company, because straight up or down vote does absolutely nothing. And I've had some shareholder groups to say, well, it gives us an opportunity to have dialogue with the company. Well, you have access to the company and you should have that dialogue in advance, because the shareholders own the company and the board reports to the shareholders for the most part. And so in that regard, I would much rather see a dialogue on compensation prior to a straight up or down vote.
Ann?
Ann Simpson, CalFIS. I'm concerned about us overstretching the auditor by suggesting that they start looking at compensation. You know, the board has a job here. So just harken back to what I said earlier, that we need to look at this whole series of checks and balances and roles and relationships in its totality. So this is why it matters that we have majority voting, so that you can vote no, not just I withhold on compensation committee members. That really matters. Proxy access really matters. And staggered boards are a problem. And because of those barriers to the board being accountable, we're hunting around for these ways, like say on pay, invented in the UK, is a bit of a feather duster to tickle public opinion with. It doesn't actually get to the heart of the problem. And I think in terms of the message, there's very few circumstances where you need very detailed individual discussions. The big picture stuff is clear. You need money at risk. You need performance measures which fit with the strategy and the life cycle of the industry. And just benchmarking yourself to what everyone else is doing is often a problem, because they're all late woebegone. They're all above average chief executives. And before you know it, you've got sectors where it's out of control. I really agree with what Bonnie said, though, for the auditor's role, which is that it's about tying it into risk management and their appraisal and responsibilities in that department. But let's not try and load the auditor up with everything. That's what the board's there to do.
Mike.
This is Mike Head, and I think I mirror a lot. I think table stakes is making sure the disclosures in the proxy are accurate and reliable, and that's a combination of internal auditors and external auditing. From an audit role point of view, I think there are some venues that, other than what's been mentioned that I've heard, is, and I think, Tony, you were starting to get at it, is use of company assets and T&E reimbursement and other things that are benefits that executive officers, use of corporate planes, the straight-up proxy compensation and what you can tie to contracts. I think the corporate governance and holding the board accountable and the comp committee is the right way to go, and the auditor is just making sure that process is in place and the risk management governance. But where I think the value of the audit efforts is in these the Tyco stuff, the misuse and not in accordance with the policies that the company and the board have set. So the auditors are in a better position to say, are they, what they're seeing in the financial statements aligned with corporate policies that the governance structure has approved and that that structure is adequate, versus trying to make due decisions for the board and the board comp committee. And I think there's going to be more opportunities for misuse of classification and use of company assets than the governance structure itself.
Turning to the two remaining issues just very, very quickly. On inspections, Barbara Roper, you indicated that the PCOB should develop a robust and formalized system for analyzing inspection findings and using that analysis to inform other board activities. And then, Bonnie, you mentioned that as well. And that you thought we should do a better job focusing our inspections on significant issues and risks. I think, Mike, we've already touched on your point with respect to inspection, but I was wondering whether or not Barbara, you or Bonnie wanted to say anything on that issue. Barbara, do you want to?
I mean, I'll just say briefly, we talked about this at the last standing advisory group meeting. You know, it's my understanding that the board is working on ways to use the information from inspections effectively to inform the standard setting process. It's something that we've talked about as an issue within SAG for a number of years, that the information comes out of inspections has the potential to really be meaningful in terms of helping to identify problem areas and areas where there may be changes that are needed to the standards, the audit standards. I think it flows together well with the notion of a fraud center, which is, you know, something I very strongly support, that the PCAOB just should think about how to formalize that process, make sure there's a clear formal process for how the information that comes out of those procedures then informs the standard setting process and the other things that the board does.
And then, Kelvin, you mentioned, and this probably is a conversation which is so large that we might want to save it for another time, but in a snippet you mentioned investor education and the expectation gap. Do you want to briefly comment on your concerns?
Sure.
There.
Sure. It's Kelvin Blake. I don't know to what extent the PCAOB currently reaches out to investors, but I did suggest that perhaps they can start an investor education program where they're making investors aware of the audit process, both the benefits and the limitations of the audit process, and perhaps in an effort to narrow the expectation gap that now exists. Also recommended perhaps encouraging senior-level members of the accounting profession to meet more often with investor groups so that the investor groups can explain, you know, what their expectations are from the audit process and help to improve audit transparency, what effects investors think the new accounting standards may have on the their decisions, and any other relevant issues.
Well, before concluding, I'd like to point out that yesterday the board announced that the PCOB is seeking nominations for a standing advisory group, and a copy of our press release is in your packet. And as I think most of you know, this standing advisory group is an integral part of the PCOB standard setting process. And it would be extremely helpful if members of this group could help identify potential candidates by either nominating them yourselves or asking the candidates to submit a self-nomination form, which can be found on our website. And I think that, or you ought to feel free to contact Marty Bauman directly with respect to that. In conclusion, because it's very close to 5, I don't want to give Dan the last remarks and the other board members if they care to make any. In terms of, I think what we'll do in terms of follow-up is we'll prepare a generic summary of today's meeting, which we'll distribute to all the group members. I think we'll get back to each of the panels for any possible follow-up issues prior to our next meeting. I think it's been an extremely productive day, and on all the panels there have been recommendations. And I'm not sure how realistic or feasible it will be, but I talked to a couple of folk during the break, and
There may be follow-up items that which we will want to discuss with each panel, and then get a work product out of you if it makes sense. So we will summarize. We'll get back in touch. I want to thank very much all of you for your participation. I want to particularly thank Joanne Heinemann, who's put this together, both substantively and administratively. Joanne, you did a terrific job. I want to thank Jennifer Stokes and Bob, you're out of sight, out of mind, but you've been extremely helpful, and we're totally depending upon you to continue to be helpful. So thank you very much, and we appreciate very much all of your participation. I don't know whether any of the board members want to make final comments.
I'll just join you in saying thank you to everybody for your participation. You've certainly given us a lot to think about, and I look forward to the next meeting of this group.